Please tell us about the order and how you came to discover it exists.
The order is truly a secret society. It was founded in the United States at Yale University in 1833. Many of these photographs are the 15 sitting around a table, and they have the skull and the crossbones sitting on the table in front of them. It is the symbol of death, and it has been called the Brotherhood of Death, and I think it probably more adequately should be called the Brotherhood of Death. What are the objectives? In the words of one member, might is right. If you have the power, you use it to achieve your objectives. What is the objective? As you look at the histories of individual members, it can only be one thing: to acquire power, to keep power, to use power for their own purposes.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Friday, the 19th of January 2021. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Martin Summers is off helping a friend install a new gas hot water system. But so tonight we have former Sunday Times Richlist journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Cahill. In the second part, Fox News every Sunday has become required viewing. I hate to say it, but yes, Murdoch required viewing there in the battle to crush investigative journalism like this show. In the West, the next revolution is the show on Fox. An update this week from Steve Hilton on the apparent COVID bioweapon kingpin, Dr. Peter Daszak, president of the gain-of-function obsessed EcoHealth Alliance, which was working undercover for the Pentagon. And the UK-US virus, this is what they're uncovering there, made undercover in China. But the BBC won't tell you anything about the most important in the story in the world right now, exposing the COVID bioengineering criminals. Plus, they're killing the high street, small and medium businesses, while the transatlantic giants thrive. Are the Tory party killing capitalism? There's an interesting idea. A new article this week is not impressed by the rabbit hole the so-called Tories are taking us down. Also tonight, it was revealed several years ago that MI5 uncovered an April 1945 Stern Gang, the Jewish terrorist, plot to assassinate Winston Churchill. But what about JFK and Bobby Kennedy? Did the Israeli mafia also have a hand in or even direct those assassinations of the Kennedys? A new but instantly banned off BitChute French documentary, Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers, subtitled JFK and 9/11, 50 Years of the Deep State. And we hear author Laurent Guillenot talking about that, and you won't be able to see or hear that because it's now been banned. Thank you very much, BitChute. So what happens, of course, is companies that host BitChute will be served with legal notices saying this is anti-Semitic, take it down, or we will sue you for X amount of dollars and report you to the police as a crime for putting that documentary there. So that's how it works, folks. And if you're an internet service provider, you're probably going to take it down, aren't you? So I imagine that's around somewhere, that documentary's title again. And we'll be hearing a clip from it a bit later. That's Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers. And the greatest historical novelist in the English language, well, I think he is anyway, I'm very opinionated about him, it once a bestseller, the great psychological warfare officer and deception planner of World War II, now buried in more ways than one, Dennis Wheatley, on how the forces of darkness are threatening to come out on top. And finally, author Tim Cohen, on how the Israelis may eventually turn back to God. This show is repeated at 11 on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week. That's 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream and over Sunday lunch in two places from noon at richieallen.co.uk and camberleysradioq.com. Do please make recordings yourself. Sometimes we do get hit with gremlins. Feel free to download and rebroadcast the show anywhere you like. And we'll list you there. But do credit this show at thisweek.org.uk. And you can hear a lot more of the longer interviews that I do, the ones we don't have time to broadcast on this stream throughout the rest of the week. But first, it's established control over the cab market, Uber, but it's to be reined in Too late, of course. The days of regulated cabs where you can be sure you're not going to be sexually assaulted or even murdered by your cab driver, are they over? And MI6 apologised to gays who were prevented from being spies. Supposedly, only Burgess, McLean and the rest weren't, including the former deputy head of MI6, Sir Peter Hayman, who was bisexual and an alleged paedophile to boot. So why is today's announcement by the present MI6 boss even happening? And Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees admits to being a close personal friend of the jailed former Russian politician Alexei Navalny, despite Navalny working for the oligarchs, stripping the country of its wealth, that's Russia, that is, over in the 1990s under the puppet Boris Yeltsin. Marvin, our Bristol mayor, seems to think Navalny was stopping corruption. They met when they were both tapped up doing the fellowship program at a big American university. We'll be hearing a clip about that. And our special investigation this week, where we're going to start, into the wealth of the British royal family. What happens when rich and powerful people decide their money is better spent crushing stories about their wealth? They're not prepared to be called out for their greed, or is it even criminality? Here in Bristol, we have a similar problem, albeit on a much smaller scale. People who are supposed to represent us that don't wish to be accountable at all. Ever since the last election in 2016, the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees has refused to be interviewed by this programme, coming out with various excuses, booking in, then pulling out. Then his friend Pat Hart, who's the managing editor of Bristol Community Radio, took this show off the air, seemingly permanently. So now even the number two candidate, Sandy Hall-Rothman, who's the Green Mayor candidate here in Bristol, who will be very soon, has been similarly ducking requests, mostly just not replying for the last month. He doesn't want to be interviewed on this show, maybe. Well, let's see. Why are Marvin and Sandy so shy? Or are they just part of a clique who intend to take our money and spend it as they see fit? Are they part of an unaccountable Bristol group known as the Society of Merchant Venturers, what former head of news and current affairs at HTV, James Garrett, called the Bristol Mafia, incorporated as a legal personality under an arcane law which allows them to avoid all scrutiny about their finances, except by, guess what, the Privy Council. Yes, under a royal charter. So joining me to discuss this, and particularly the amazing ability of the royal family, the Queen herself, to hide her personal wealth, is former Sunday Times Rich List journalist Kevin Cahill. Hi, Kevin. Welcome.
Hi, Tony. Yeah. No, there's been such interesting stuff coming up. I mean, Rob Evans had a fine piece in The Guardian about how they fiddled, the royal family fiddled the law and pay no tax.
Now, do you want to just start by taking us back to your time at the Sunday Times? Because I know you were starting to, basically one of your main tasks there was figuring out people's land holdings, because a lot of these rich and powerful people, they inherit land, and then sometimes it's not registered, so it's very difficult to find out they even own it. And in which case, it can be quite a good place to hide your wealth. If you're wealthy and powerful, land, well, and you were digging stuff out, weren't you?
Not very much. It was one of the, back in those days, about 65% of the land in the United Kingdom wasn't registered anywhere, because various rules had come and gone and you didn't have to register. That's changed a bit. They're now trying to force everybody to register, but it's very partial and it's very incomplete. And of course, the laws, the Queen's people get to look at them before they're passed in Parliament. Prince Charles gets to look at them. And if he doesn't want people to be able to buy their freeholds, they don't get permission. The law was fixed.
So, I mean, this latest, the latest headlines from The Guardian are pretty shocking, aren't they? Almost all the other national papers have taken it up, including the BBC were broadcasting it. That the Queen actually got a change in the law to conceal her wealth. But this is going back quite a way, isn't it? It's back to the 1970s. I think even, was it the Heath or the Wilson governments that were trying to make people's shareholdings more transparent? And, there was a lot of corruption around at the time. Of course, there still is. But the Queen managed to sort of sidestep that.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, I worked in Parliament as well, in parallel. And I was always puzzled. Political parties would say they're going to do this, that, or the other. And then something would turn up on the statute book, and it wasn't what they said they would do. And I got puzzled eventually. I never spotted what Rob Evans spotted, the Guardian reporter, that they were actually being given sight of legislation before it was passed. So they were able to change it. But the Queen's wealth remains completely hidden, and there was a real tussle about it. Generally, we treated... The key thing was the Crown Estate. This is all the land left over from history. It's about 400,000 acres. But, as we now discovered recently from The Guardian, it's also the foreshore, where quite recently the Crown Estate has raised huge sums of money in rent.
Okay, can you just get an idea of 400,000 acres? What's that? About 500,000 acres. How big is that? About a county? A bit bigger? A bit less?
It's about three quarters the size of Cornwall. That's the simple way of putting it.
Okay, yeah, roughly, all right.
Yeah, roughly, very roughly. But again, her private estates are not registered in the land registry. The only place I ever found in the land registry was, wait for this, Rockall. Rockall is registered in the name of the Queen. So, but all the other stuff, it was look up stuff, guess, and all the rest of it. Because it simply wasn't registered.
Okay, so the Queen started creeping up the rich list whilst you were there, but then a letter arrived, didn't it?
No, she didn't creep up the rich list. We put her at the top because of the Crown Estate. The Crown Estate was worth about, I don't know, 6 to 8 billion. And after about 6 years, Murdoch, the same Rupert, got a letter from the palace saying that we were getting this wrong, Philip and myself, that we were including public assets like the Crown Estate. And Murdoch bowed the knee and suggested we were wrong to include the Crown Estate and could we please take it out? So we did. And this reduced her about 300 million from 4 or 5 billion.
Okay. Well, that was but I mean, at the end of the day, I suppose Murdoch is thinking he's going to pick his enemies. If he doesn't really want to pick a fight with the person who's in charge of the law in Britain.
No, and he probably knew before any of us knew that the Crown got a look at the legislation before it was passed. But the interesting thing was we weren't able to pin it down properly. But in the first year of the coalition government, 2010, the coalition government granted the Queen the freehold on the Crown Estate. She did become officially the owner. So she should have gone back in the list plus the Crown Estate. 6 billion, 10 billion. She'd have been way up at the top.
Well, the article itself is headline is revealed the Queen lobbied for a change in the law to hide her private wealth. We did cover it last week. It was in the Guardian Observer the previous weekend. But it is an enormous revelation, really. I mean, yeah, obviously, what's happened here is that some people, like the Queen, are so wealthy that they don't need to be put on the rich list. Obviously, you're not a lawyer, Kevin, but do you think that you had a case to say that the Crown Estate should be included in her personal wealth?
I think it should have been. It was imprecise. I read all the Crown Estate stuff. I got stuff out of the National Archives. I went down to Kew and spent days there, and I couldn't pin it down. Not totally. But then the coalition government, the Tory element of it, solved all that. She is the official owner of the Crown Estate. And that is when she should have been restored to, you know, somewhere very near the top.
So what Rob Evans says with David Pegg. Is the Queen successfully lobbied the government to change a draft law in order to conceal her embarrassing private wealth, in inverted commas, embarrassing, from the public? According to documents discovered by The Guardian, a series of government memos unearthed in the National Archives reveal that Elizabeth Windsor's private lawyer put pressure on ministers to alter proposed legislation to prevent her shareholdings from being disclosed to the public. So they are her shareholdings. It seems strange that, obviously, the key word here is embarrassment. Yeah. What we've got here is an incredibly mega wealthy monarch who is abusing her power in order to hide that wealth.
Well, I mean, it's every other country that usually the head of state, the president, has to put their tax stuff in the public domain and certainly has to declare their assets. And we've got a head of state who doesn't declare anything and who doesn't produce tax returns and whose wills, think of the wills, can be hidden. There's no legal obligation for a royal will to be published, you know, in probate or in wherever, by the Inland Revenue. So it's a very, very odd anomaly to have the head of state with no listed assets and no tax returns.
Okay, well, let's try and fill in the gap, Kevin. I'm going to take you back to when were you doing this at the Sunday Times?
From 1988. I was one of the researchers in the year before it appeared. And then I stayed there till 91, 92, but stayed in touch. And usually it was to do stuff relating to the Queen. if anybody was going to be thrown off the diving board, it was me.
Right. Well, I mean, I hope you can swim okay. Let's go back to 1990 then, and can you paint us a picture of what you think the Queen's real wealth actually is?
Okay, well, start with the Crown Estate. You're talking about 6 to 10 billion. I mean, it's the finest real estate in Britain. And think of places like Regent Street, the big park, and lots of property in Mayfair.
Yeah, Hyde Park,
Hyde Park, that's it. And then there is the Royal Art Collection. Again, that's concealed. I think either some or all of it probably does actually belong to the Queen. But it's in confusing trusts. It's not clear who controls the trusts. It's not clear who owns the actual paintings and statues and things. They're for the benefit of the nation, but it just doesn't say who owns them. And I think they belong to the Queen. So that's another billion with the Crown Estate. Say 6, 6, 1, 7. And then her investments and everything, which used to be handled years ago by Barings. And you'd very occasionally get a soul from Barings who'd give you an idea. And back then, you're talking about 600 million. But since Barings went under, the kind of the investments in Unilever and all the other big companies have just vanished. They're not listed.
There is a bit of a mystery, isn't there, about the Bank of England? We see the Queen's head on all of our coins and our banknotes. Could she be a shareholder in that? Because I know the Bank of England doesn't reveal who owns its shares. I think it's also one of those organisations that is constituted under a royal charter or incorporated under a royal charter of some kind.
Correct. It was a private... for years and years, the Bank of England was a private bank. It wasn't state-owned, and it's switched in and out of being a state institution, but who the shareholders are is not clear.
Well, the only way to find out is go and ask the Privy Council. Are they likely to tell you?
In the most secret part of Britain. Very little is known about what the Privy Council does, but I'll give you a clue. The Lord President of the Privy Council is Jacob Rees-Mogg. It'll give you an idea.
It does. It certainly does. Yeah. Also, I mean, this just doesn't stop at the Queen, does it? I mean, maybe before we go on to look at Prince Charles, you could say something about the Queen's international land holdings, because I know you've written quite a lot about the legal position in countries like Canada and Australia, where legally one could argue that the Queen still owns all the land.
She does. Canada is particularly aggressive in asserting the fact that the Queen owns Canada. There's all the kind of publications by the Forestry Commission and places like that in Canada always insist that she is the ultimate freeholder. She owns the land. And all the stuff the Canadian government do is done on her behalf, not in her name, on her behalf. So all of Canada is a crown possession, the same as New Zealand, the same as Northern Ireland, and the same as England.
But I mean...
So, yeah. But
practically,
she owns,
speaking, though, Kevin, what does that mean? I mean, does it mean the Queen can take a piece of land and build a villa on it anywhere she likes in those countries?
It's anomalous. Suppose she wants to build a mansion outside Toronto. How does the Toronto Planning Board deal with the owner, plus who is also their head of state? The pressure the Crown can bring without actually forcing anything is enormous. Influence, big thing. And yeah, in theory, in Canada, she could override any planning law because they're all made in her name.
The Queen has got a bit of a problem over in Vancouver. When we were over there this time last year, actually, I was chatting to people who were talking about the local Squamish, Musqueam and Tlecit First Nation peoples having managed to win a vote in the Vancouver Parliament, where they have some kind of, Vancouver City Council or whatever it is there.
And British Columbia,
saying that this land was actually not the Queen's and it was actually property of the First Nations. And this was quite a massive issue over in Vancouver, so there seems to be a bit of pushback.
There is pushback. It's come very late in the day. Canada became a possession of the Crown back in the 1700s. No recognition, direct or indirect, was given to any native title. Because they couldn't read or write, they were assumed, or didn't use written materials, they were assumed to be illiterate and couldn't possibly own land. So the Crown took it all. It was dead simple. But I think it's the British Columbia, which is where Vancouver is situated, I think they passed. But it's in dispute, and I'll tell you where there's another huge dispute going on, up in the north with the Inuit people. They have made a lot of progress in almost becoming freeholders, and they have a big lump. I mean, it's tens of millions of acres in northern Canada. And they have established a terrific amount of control. You want to go and shoot film in Inuit territory, you don't get permission from the Crown, you get permission from the Inuit people. And there's been some progress in Australia too.
I mean, chatting over there, the basic timeline was back in the 19th century, this land was claimed for God by the British Empire, and the Queen owned it on behalf of God because we were Christians, the great English, turning up there, obviously the French too. And we said, well, you people are illiterate pagans, and therefore this land is our property.
That is pretty, it's a loose story, but it's not inaccurate. The other thing you should remember is that the Crown in Scotland holds the land from God. That's Scottish law. So the thing about God and the Crown, nobody talks about here in England.
But they don't, and especially with Prince Charles, who doesn't, he has a very deistic kind of belief in God, if he does have any belief in God. And he certainly, doesn't believe in Christian God, because he is supposed to be the defender of faiths rather than the defender of the faith, which includes, basically pagan faiths and all sorts that aren't, don't say that God owns the land. Anyway, so possibly there's a bit of a problem coming along with that. But let's get a look. Anyway, let's get on to Prince Charles now, because he's in a way much more interesting, because he's taking a very, very political role, isn't he, these days, Kevin?
Who is this?
Prince Charles.
Oh, yeah. He's asserting himself. And he's, how do you put this? The duchy, which has got lots of land all over the place, which works hand in glove with the Crown Estate, has become much more assertive, like allowing people to change the colour of the paint on their doors. And it certainly doesn't allow them to buy the freehold. You're a leaseholder of the duchy, most of the housing down there.
Yes, so there's a story again with Rob Evans, who seems to have taken a few leaves out of your book, Kevin, and he's saying Prince Charles vetted the laws that stop his tenants buying their homes. The royals used secret procedures to approve laws that gave special exemptions to the Duchy of Cornwall, and this is when the coalition government started granting tenants the right to buy their homes. This is not applied to Prince Charles's home, so they can't buy those, and he managed to stop that going through. Now, it's to a certain extent I sympathize with him. I think it's wrong for people to be allowed to buy their own homes, but then if they're a council tenant or a housing association tenant. But, you can understand that someone who's in one of those places, who's got a reasonably reliable income and cannot get somewhere else, anywhere comparable, would rather put their annual, their weekly payments or their monthly payments into their own property rather than, just keep paying rent forever.
Of course. That's the whole... But this is the anomaly between capitalism and... community ownership. To make community ownership work, you need to change everything and make sure the absolute key to everything is security of tenure. Now, interesting, in the United States, going back to the 1860s, you couldn't more, if you were a small holder, if you got one of the 160 acre farms that the United States was handing out to, taking from the Indians and handing out to the settlers, you couldn't mortgage your property and a bank could not take it from you. So the Americans got themselves complete security of tenure. And that's the problem here. If you don't have freehold, you don't have security of tenure. If you're a leaseholder of the duchy or the Crown Estate, you've got a landlord and you have no real ultimate security of tenure.
So did something similar happen in the north of Ireland around the time of the plantations? Because a lot of land was dished out then, wasn't it? Actually, the best land in Ireland was dished out to soldiers who had fought for the English.
Ah, and the book I've just written, which hasn't been published yet, about who owns Ireland, and that is the case almost universally in Ireland. Every time the local nationalists or whatever they were in those days lost a battle or something, the soldiers who had fought against them were given all the land. And this explains a lot of the problems in Northern Ireland. The descendants of those soldiers who were not, strictly speaking, Irish, have quite a grip on the land in Northern Ireland. The other people who had a huge slice of the Northern Ireland settlements were livery companies in London.
Constituted under royal charters.
Yep. And the land was seized from, just people who didn't even, who may have been friendly with people who fought on the other side. They didn't go around saying, you fought against us at wherever it was, the Boyne. They just said, you're Irish, you're a Catholic, so we're taking your land. Zap. That was largely how it was acquired.
Yeah, sowing the seeds for, I suppose, quite a lot of things like the, you know, 1970s and 80s, 90s troubles, this kind of thing.
Indeed, it's part of the issue. But the curiosity is, in the Republic of Ireland, everybody thinks they own their land, especially farmers, and they don't. In 1921, the Crown transferred its royal ownership to the Irish state. So every farmer, the Irish absolutely believe they own their farms and their houses and everything. They don't. The state does, in lieu of the Crown.
Amazing. So, I mean, so you can, in all practicality, though, surely there's no difference because you can sell that place to somebody else whenever you feel like it. It's not as if you've got to go and ask the Crown for permission. No. The Crown are not taking rent, are they?
No, or the state. In effect, the overlordship has become almost absent. Transactions are conducted. You know, a farmer sells land in Ireland. It's conducted as though he owned it. But strictly speaking, he doesn't. And it just got eroded over time. There was no.
So, I mean, yeah, but Kevin, from a practical point of view, it doesn't really mean anything, does it?
No, not in the Republic. And that's crept over into there. But think here that if you have the freehold of your house, in theory, that's it. But in actual fact, if you read the legislation, freehold is actually a lease.
You've done books on all this stuff. In fact, you've done not only that you own Who Owns Ireland, you were just talking about, Who Owns Britain, and you've also done this thing called Who Owns the World, which is, I mean, you know, you really seem to be the man on all this. And it's extremely important, of course, for people to have real security of tenure, not to, you know, get to their, say, their 40s and 50s and find, oh, gosh, you know, actually someone's going to do something with this land. I didn't own it at all. And are there any countries in the world that, where you actually do personally own the land rather than only through the state?
Try Russia. Russia, land in Russia is owned by the state and then privately. The split is very, very like the split in the United States. In the United States, the federal government owns 30% of all the land. The rest is private. You know, and the ownership is an absolute form of freehold. The place that has put ownership in the Constitution, it's one of only three countries, is Russia. In Russia, you have a right to own land. And I think
okay, what are the other two countries then?
One was Mexico and the other was Switzerland. And even the Swiss one is obscure, but it looks like absolute freehold. But again, it's lost in the mists of history. You know, but the right to own land independently of the state is very rare. To do Who Owns the World, I read 191 constitutions, and I only found three where your right to land was stated. In every other constitution, you had the right to own property, which wasn't defined as land.
Yeah. Well, they're sneaky, aren't they? These governments like to think that we're all running around and they're the farmers and we're the little people going doing the jobs for them out on the farm. But anyway, going back to the Queen, I know you think that you've estimated the seabed could be worth £6 billion. Now, the Queen managed to acquire this back in the 70s. The ownership of the British coastline, Rob Evans says in this article, is as old as the monarchy itself, but her right to collect royalties from wind and wave power is more recent. It was granted by Tony Blair's Labour government in a 2004 Act of Parliament. The Crown Estate, which manages the royal property portfolio, is holding the first auction of seabed plots for wind farm turbines in a decade. It emerged this week that bidding has reached a record high as energy firms look to diversify away from oil. But, he goes on to say, the story of how Queen Elizabeth was given the rights to exploit the renewable energy has its roots in the North Sea oil boom of the last century. Now, I mean, if this is so, 6 billion, I mean, surely this money where these wind farms are coming from should be coming into the Treasury. It shouldn't be going to the Queen.
No, you'd have thought that. Well, the split is when the Tories handed the Crown Estate to the Queen in 2010, she got a permanent 25% levy, as it were, on the revenues of the Crown Estate in lieu of what used to be the Crown Settlement, you know, the annual grant from the government, from the state. But the ownership of the foreshore and the land between off the beaches, that is as old. Rob is completely correct there. That is as old as the history of land ownership in Britain. All that the Tony Blair's government did was bring the use of rights of way and leaves over the land into modern rules. It wasn't a re-grant. That wasn't granting anything extra. The right was there. And if you could persuade people to pay you to cross your land, all Blair's government did was update that. But the big change was in 2010.
So 6 billion is what you estimate the seabed and the coastline is worth. If we add that to the Queen's active land holdings in the UK, then that's something like £13 billion it's worth.
Correct.
That's so roughly. Is she at number one?
Well, this was the. No, she isn't. There are some oligarchs living here and some Indian families who are would have more money than that. I think one year it was one or two Russian oligarchs who were living in Britain came top of the list, and they would have had more than 13 billion. I mean, there are billionaires everywhere you look nowadays, common as muck.
Well, actually, James Dyson is top, Kevin, and he apparently has got 16 billion, so the Queen could be number one.
She could be very close to it.
Of course, the problem here is this is assets, not cash, isn't it? It's quite difficult to turn that into money.
Not that difficult. The foreshore tells you how you turn assets into money. You charge people rent across your land. And the new assessment of her wealth would take asset value of the Crown Estate, which I think is about 6 billion, it would then take the revenues from the foreshore, which were about 300 million. You multiply that by 10, it gives you 3 billion and so on. And they're escalating revenues, especially with wind farms. To get out to your wind farm and to bring the electricity back, you have to cross the foreshore. So somebody is paying rent.
Well, I imagine that's part of the deal, isn't it? If you get your concession out to build a wind farm, you surely have to, as part of that, you've got access to it. I mean, maybe no one else will have, but you will.
I mean, if the government, say, gives you planning consent to stick a big wind farm off the coast of Norfolk, that doesn't come with what are called the way leaves, you know, passage out and passage back. You negotiate that with the Crown Estate.
So anyway, folks, I think looking at the 7 billion on the land and the 6 billion of the seabed, you know, which is, I suppose, this is a potential asset value of all sorts of things, of mineral rights and things, etc. Oil still remaining under the North Sea and elsewhere around the coast of Britain. It is quite nice to see the Queen popping right up to the top of the rich list again, at least on this show. I doubt if it's going to be up there on the Sunday Times. I notice also, Kevin, whilst we're talking about the Murdoch Empire, I mean, you having worked with them, I mean, how did you find to work with? Who were your editors, etc.? And, you know, how was it? Were they good editors to work with?
Yeah, with the editor of The Rich System was Philip Beresford, who was wonderful to work with. The next person was Andrew Neil. Andrew was okay. He was very, very busy, Andrew Neil. He wasn't hands-on, especially with The Rich List. But Murdoch would show up. The only thing in News International, the two things that Murdoch was focused on, especially when he visited, one was the News of the World, and the other was The Rich List. The week before The Rich List would come out, Murdoch would phone up to know who was on it. So, he took a personal interest. But the other thing, when he would come to visit, he'd call in at the Sunday Times for a chat. But then he'd spend hours at the News of the World going over the gossip.
Right, getting intelligence on all his enemies, probably, getting that from him.
He had a way of keeping total surveillance, didn't he?
He did, yes, due to phone hacking and things like that, we now know. As a Sunday newspaper, I mean, I do a weekly program on here, but I think I'd love to work on a Sunday paper where you've got a bit more time to write stuff, and it's all published on the Sunday. I quite like the Sunday papers. In the old days, of course, they used to have much more in the way of news coverage from around the world, particularly photojournalism from around the world. Anywhere there was a conflict or hotspot, say, for example, like now we've got in Burma, you know, you would see loads of pictures in the Sunday's colour supplement from Burma, from brave journalists who were down there making sure that we could see what was going on. That all went. What happened?
Well, television. Television and mobile phones. You can now get your stuff from Burma, from Myanmar, instantly from an amateur photographer. They just stand in the street with their mobile. So that kind of ended the career. Who were the Sunday Times had some wonderful war correspondents.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was Don McCullen was working there when Murdoch took it over. I think he sacked Don McCullen.
He sacked Harry Evans, which I would never forgive him.
Andrew Neil, maybe. So who was Harry?
Harry was the editor of the Sunday Times. It was Harry Evans made the Sunday Times what it was. And Murdoch bought the papers from the Thompsons, Sunday Times, Times, and the News of the World, and the Sun. And Murdoch gave undertakings to Parliament, that he wouldn't change the editor. And he immediately pushed Harry out of the Sunday Times into the Times, and then tried to get rid of him from the Times, having guaranteed to Parliament he wouldn't do it. But he did. But it was the huge reputation of the Sunday Times rests entirely, almost entirely, on the work of Harry Evans,
who died last year. Murdoch's effect on Fleet Street? Because, of course, Fleet Street now is no more. It was all a kind of technological revolution where everybody is... these things are desktop published in the house. There are no, there's no print unions. It's just something on a computer.
Before I joined The Rich List, I used to write for the Sunday Times for the business section about IT. And I was writing stories about the Americans playing hooky and doing fiddles to keep us out of export markets. And eventually, Roger Eglin, the editor, came to me and said, Murdoch likes your stuff, but he'd prefer if you wrote about something else. And it then emerged that Murdoch was a board director of the largest arms company in America, United Technologies. And they had a huge investment in IT. And Murdoch was 100% behind the United Kingdom being pushed out of IT markets and to make way for the United States and big American companies. It was all commercial.
Well, he's getting on a bit now, and who knows, maybe he's finding as he comes to the end of his life or closer towards it, a bit of a conscience, because we've got, although I doubt it, to be honest with you, what we've got now is we've got him running obviously his publications like The Sun, The Times, Times Radio, but he's also running this thing called Talk Radio over here, which is doing what I would consider is the only pushback against the what seems like permanent lockdowns going on in Britain. But more importantly, over in the US, we're going to hear in the second part, Kevin, this investigation into the Pentagon-funded, Fauci-funded program at the Wuhan lab, which was doing gain-of-function research after it had been banned in the US by Obama. And that is to say with coronaviruses, the very virus which came out supposedly from Wuhan, looks now as if it was one of these man-made, manufactured viruses made by them. And the only people really looking into this, delving into it, people like Steve Hilton at Fox News. So who knows? Maybe Rupert Murdoch is, you know, having a bit of a change of heart, although I don't think he'd still be prepared to put the Queen as number one, as we've just done, at the top of his rich list.
The other
thing I remember was looking at the Rothschild family was I was down giving a talk in Totnes about 10 years ago, and it was just the same weekend as the rich list had come out that year. And there's no Rothschild on there anywhere. But what there is an advert by the side of the rich list, which you never normally see, for the Rothschild wines, you know. And I thought this is a very sort of subtle joke, a little in joke they're doing here, because not only is the Queen not on there, but Jacob Rothschild and his family, Nat Rothschild and the rest of them, they don't appear either. So I wonder, are there any other people like the Queen who are so wealthy and powerful that they can just disappear their names from the list, Kevin?
Murdoch is not on the rich list because he's an American citizen. But then lots of the Russian oligarchs who were on the rich list were Russian citizens, not British. It's but the Rothschilds is interesting is because they're as rich as they always were and as influential. And all their assets are hidden. There is no public land record of what land they own or anything. But it's that case is the same for many, many of the billionaires. They hide their stuff offshore, especially in British tax havens, or, you know, other tax havens.
I guess that's where we should finish this, really, is this is the other thing about the Queen, which is pointed out by Rob and many others. And I'll put a link up to the article on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which is that not only has the Queen got all this hidden wealth here in the UK, but she's also controller and personally appoints the people that lead almost all of the tax havens, which are these dependencies, aren't they?
That's right. They got a special section in the rich list because years and years ago I worked for a merchant bank. Oh, yes, it was the first rich list. And when it came out, one of the directors of the bank chivied me. He said, come on, Kevin, you've missed two out of every three of our clients. And I'm thinking, two out of three. And that bank had lots of clients with land, and all their clients held their land in the UK through Swiss trusts. So there was no chance of ever pinning it down.
Well, that's what the super rich do, isn't it? They just make
that's
sure
what
that
they
everybody,
do.
You know, they make sure that wealth is incredibly well hidden. And, you know, of course, the problem is that you've also got senior people in the media in the same boat, you know, the Daily Mail, etc., with their money squirreled away in these tax havens. And, of course, they're not going to be going to do an investigation on themselves now, are they?
No,
anyway, look, let's move on to look at surveillance, Kevin, which I know you love to delve into. Can you just first off explain why you think this is such an important topic? It's often, I mean, we talk about it as a civil liberties issue, but it's also potentially a practical issue, isn't it, for individuals to maybe actually get some compensation back from these various organizations that may be illegally stealing their data.
Absolutely correct. I've kind of done this out of as an issue of principle, but the reality is that 37 million people, at a minimum of 37 million, are entitled to COMPO. And the party who have blocked all this is the current government. They have made it impossible to sue the people stealing most of the data in the United Kingdom. And the again, we can say this totally safely, Tony. They've all been named in court judgments, and they've been named in Parliament, so we know who they are. Microsoft, Google, Facebook. If you try and sue, the courts have said those companies are stealing your data. So it's a matter of record. So there's no ifs, whats, or buts. These companies steal your data here in the United Kingdom. Now, if you sue them, as I've done recently, you find suddenly they're not here. They're just like the offshore rich. Sorry, we don't do business in the United Kingdom. You were saying, but you've got huge offices in London, all this sort of thing. No, sorry. The people who steal your data are based in California. And one company, I think it might have been Facebook, no, it was Google, said to me, no, that's okay, we're offshore, but if you want to sue to see your data, that's fine. You go to a court in England and they'll give you permission to go to America and go to court and sue us in America. Joke. What Google said to me is you can have permission to come to America and sue us for your UK data rights. But the key thing is all these companies are stealing data and they're all liable to pay compensation. And they've made a technical error. They all say, no, we have no business in the United Kingdom. And you're saying, but you've got these huge offices in London. And they say, no, they just do technical stuff. The revenue, the ads they sell, if you take Google and Facebook, the revenues all go to Dublin, which is a much lower tax rate. And they're very difficult to pin down. But the revenue have never woken up to the fact that to provide a service in England or the United Kingdom, they have to cross into UK jurisdiction. And I believe the revenue have been slow to spot this. They can be caught. But, you know, when you go in a court and the judge says to you, I'm terribly sorry, they're doing your data out of California, it means the judge doesn't understand either. But all these companies are liable for compensation for the data they steal.
Okay, so have there been any successful court cases?
Yep. I've got judgments against Yahoo, Facebook, who got the judgments knocked out, Google, I've got a judgment against the Information Commissioner, YouTube, and someone else. And I got money from, I'm not allowed to name the company, and it's convenient not to for me, but one of the companies saw me coming and handed over the money.
Okay, so this is an out-of-court settlement, which is compensation for stealing your data. Now, that's not just you, Kevin. It's 65 million people here in Britain.
No, 37 million. And do you know where the figure is? It's in parliamentary evidence. You know, you and I can say with complete privilege that these companies are committing criminal offences, stealing the data. It's all been documented in Parliament, but nobody's done anything. The revenue is still accepting the excuse that they're not here. The judges don't understand that to actually do business at all, to for Google to give you an answer to a question, their signal comes into the United Kingdom and is subject to UK law. And everybody's gone along asleep and, you know, at the wheel. So
doesn't that just mean, really, that Google, Facebook and these Bilderberg tech giant companies are actually just more powerful than the Treasury, than the British state, than their Majesty's Revenue and Customs?
Well, let me take you a step further. There's a key judgment that underpins everything I say and all my evidence in Parliament. And it was a judgment made by an Irish judge in 2014. And he went a lot further than saying these people are engaged in mass and indiscriminate surveillance, which is criminal and unlawful, he said, it's espionage. All these companies are doing this data theft for the espionage arm of the American government. Nobody knew. I didn't notice this for ages. That what the judge actually said is that these people are breaking the Official Secrets Act as well. Now, that's getting remote. The key thing is they're stealing your data in your house and they're liable to pay you compo.
Okay, so how do you go about claiming compensation, and how much can you expect?
Well, I thought to test the situation, I brought test cases. I brought 9. If you go through the small claims court, you can get a claim in for 35 quid, very cheap. And if you want to go up, you have to pay more. But I just wanted to find out how they were playing it and what their defense was. But the bans set by the appeal court for, you know, theft of data and the distress it causes are 2.5 grand to 12.5 grand. There's serious compo possible. And I haven't quite solved the issue, but I'm very, very close. And but the question for everybody is, here's a court which makes a judgment and says, this gang of hoodlums are engaged in espionage in the United Kingdom. And have you noticed any Official Secrets Act cases anywhere?
Well, nope. No, I mean, it seems to me a lot of the Official Secrets Act stuff, they don't do it. I mean, as with things like, you know, McLean, Philby and the rest of them, because it's too embarrassing as well. Because, I mean, that's the sort of thing we'd hear here. They don't want people to know about this, Kevin. But anyway, look, let's go up to something that people maybe listeners will know a bit more about, and that is these two cases of Anne Sekulis and Julian Assange.
I think they're connected. She was working for she was a spook, and the Americans don't want to hand her over, obviously. I suspect she was working for the National Security Agency, the one that's nicking all the data, which may make her very specially sensitive.
Let me just remind listeners, this is the woman who drove into and killed Harry Dunn, driving on the wrong side of the road outside RAF Croughton.
And what the United States has done last week is to say, well, OK, Mrs. Dunn, the boy's mother, can bring a case in an American court. But in the meantime, an English court has said Julian Assange should not be extradited, and the American government is appealing it. So they're trying to... The case against Assange is 100% political. He never committed any crimes. But the people who, in the pictures he published, machine-gunned a crowd, an unarmed crowd, including 2 Reuters journalists. And nobody has ever been charged. All the details of the mass murder in the square in Baghdad are on film, and they're all known. Nobody's ever been prosecuted, and I don't know how many people were killed, but they were just machine-gunned from the air. None of them had arms. It was just a massacre. And the American government is so incensed by the embarrassment that it wants to put Julian Assange in jail for 150 years or something.
Well, so you're saying that there might be some sort of tit-for-tat going on here, that they may say, well, you know, if you want Julian Assange, we're having Anne Sekulis.
I think that's the deal that's actually operational right now. They're saying, well, she can go to an American court. And in the meantime, we would like Julian Assange. We would like the magistrate to drop the refusal to extradite him.
Yeah, I think most of us suspect this is the sort of thing that goes on in diplomatic circles, you know, that this is where these cases get decided, and a judge will just be instructed, you will find this person guilty, not guilty, whatever. You know, they're just told what to, you know, of course that makes a mockery of the whole court system.
Well, this is where, you know, you go back to the surveillance stuff. If the surveillance laws and the privacy laws aren't working in the United Kingdom, there's been a massive breakdown in the law. I mean, we're supposed, our own Human Rights Act, the UK one, guarantees us privacy. And these companies, all of them named in the court and named in Parliament, are just thieving everything and saying, terribly sorry, based in California, you can't come here. It's a con.
And it's I know you've put together a list of 18 different cases, Kevin. I think rather than go through them now, I'll just put them up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which really a chronological list of various surveillance and privacy cases, which have, I suppose, charted the course of the now officially illegal activities of these big tech companies, which, you know, people should be able to get compensation for. And well done for you know, actually taking the trouble to put a court case. So that's the 18 cases. I'll put a list of those up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. One thing, and also to your website, the Land website, wherever that is these days. Also, I suppose, to buy the Who Owns Britain, which I think is great. It, you know, you stick it in the car, and whenever you're a bit bored in one part of the country or another, you can open it up and see who owns all the county around you. It's wonderful. But let's just finish on Murdoch, because he has been involved, and as Andrew Neil, in these two new TV news ventures that are going. I think it's called GB News and News UK. So obviously not very imaginative. I think it's called News UK and GB News. So Andrew Neil and Rupert Murdoch deciding that they are going to have some kind of new news service. What they say is that the current news offering from the BBC and Sky, etc., here in Britain, is very biased, and they believe that it's actually very pro-corporate and not enough news which really interests people. And there is some evidence for that, isn't there? Because we saw, and I'm trying to remember when it was, it would be about April last year, maybe May, there was a report came out, which I think is the UN do it. Again, I'm not sure. Anyway, it's about trust in news. Trust in journalism of Britain is at an all-time low. So anyway, what do you think? Do you think that Rupert Murdoch and Andrew Neil, apparently in competition with each other, although I suppose they'll be quite chummy.
I thought Murdoch was actually funding. He's the backer of these two.
Yeah, there are two channels, though. There's one which is a streaming, like Netflix-style channel, and another one which is going to be on Freeview. So what do you make of the his attempt to come into the, you know, to bring a different offering in, Kevin?
Well, you know, as a hack myself, I have to say I like diversity. And I like, and it's terribly important in a democracy, to see what might be called the conventions challenged. And now Andrew Neil has a second to none record of, you know, really going for the jugular when doing an issue. In theory, but the trouble is Andrew is a conservative, always has been, so it's going to be tilted. It's not going to be objective. It'll have a bias, and the bias will be towards, I'll tell you the stories they will never run. They'll never run a story about tax havens and how they operate. They'll never run a story about how the ownership of land is concealed. And they certainly have an amazing track record, and this is the BBC, of never printing a story about the surveillance. Now, if I thought for 1 minute Murdoch or Andrew would, you know, attack the surveillance, I'd say wonderful, but they won't. There's a subject that's taboo for both. And their pretense that they're going to bring a new perspective, not so. There's a list of stories they'll never touch because it affects their personal interests, particularly Murdoch. So in theory, it's a great idea. In practice, we're just going to get more biased news covering something else up. It's sad, but that's, I think, how it's going to go.
David Clementi was the BBC chairman up to recently, and the BBC chairman has now been announced last month, actually, as a guy called Richard Sharp. Richard Sharp, you know, if you've maybe never seen him doing investigative reports on the TV, like Dispatches, which we're going to hear a bit from in a minute. But Richard Sharp is, guess what? He's a former banker. This is getting to be a bit of a habit, isn't it? Ever since we had the Tory who was booted out as an MP here in Bath, who then went on to run Hong Kong, or was that actually it was before it was Chris Patton.
It was Chris Patton.
So we've had financiers chairing the BBC. Now, of course, you know what you just said is surely the case for them as well. They're not going to be looking into tax havens. They will most certainly have their personal wealth in tax havens. The idea that another banker should be in charge of the BBC does seem to rather fit with the Director General who was announced in the autumn, whose name escapes me. He's so, you know, well known, famous, and respected that he's the former boss of PepsiCo, doing all their marketing stuff for them. So the idea we've got banks in charge and banks chairing the BBC and the Director General is a Pepsi man. I mean, it's no wonder that Rupert Murdoch's saying there's an opening for me here somewhere.
I mean, Murdoch is ruthlessly commercial. And more than that, as Trump just found out, Murdoch backs winners. He does not back losers. For instance, Tony Blair. Murdoch sussed him out early on and realized he could win. So he backed him. He took a gamble on Trump, but then he was giving so much support to Trump that Trump had a 50-50 chance of winning in 2016, which he did. But Murdoch, as you've seen, dumped him pretty well instantly. And Murdoch has actually said, the Fox Channel have said, no, Murdoch said that Trump is not going to ever win another American election. He's a loser. That's how you... Murdoch is 100% about money. Or 100% about money and power, perhaps.
I don't like this whole idea of financial people running entirely our media. It ends up being just a... You know, surely all it is there, it's there to, as an advertising... you know, there's no journalism left. All they're doing is advertising stuff. With a financial motive like that, everybody in every form of media other than the BBC, you've got adverts sitting next to so-called news, right? So the question here are the adverts leading the news, or is the news leading the adverts? So are the stories the more important, and has an editor got editorial freedom to write about whatever he wants? Or is he being lectured by the advertisers saying, right, well, I want a nice story to go next to my nice advert? So you could end up with a media where actually the advert's the only thing that matters and the news stories that are going between them are just kind of designed to sit nicely with those adverts.
And this is, the problem of finances. Can you imagine the chair of the BBC, whatever, the banker, and somebody from Panorama comes in and said, hey, I've got this pile of documents and they show that your bank has been flashing money around in offshore tax havens, dodgy offer. Do you think Panorama is going to be allowed to run that? And the banker won't say no. This is the art of it. He'll say, legally tricky that, we might get sued. Harry Evans, to go back to Harry, often got sued, but just as often, Harry launched the court action to support the story. Modern journalism has totally forgotten this, that 30% of Harry Evans' time was spent in court, not defending stories, but, getting facts that people wouldn't hand over by going to the courts. But that's the danger, that bankers running things like the BBC, they won't say no. They'll just say, oh, no, there might be a legal problem.
Well, actually, what they do is they'll employ a whole bunch of lawyers to say that for them, yeah.
Well, the final story about the surveillance stuff is, where are the lawyers? This is all open and shut stuff. There's enough court judgments, but there's a very odd fact in the UK, and you can read it in the Home Office website. It tells you there's no legal obligation to report a crime in the UK. A lot of people don't know that, especially people who write detective drama. There's no legal obligation to report a crime to anyone.
Now, well, there's no possibility to record to report a crime in Manchester by all everything I've heard, because apparently you phone them up to report a crime, or you go in if you're allowed to go into anywhere, if you can find somewhere to go in that's actually open and someone to speak to report a crime. They just simply weren't doing it at all. Even if there was a crime and you phoned up, they wouldn't report it, Kevin.
No, but as I say, but do you know where this came into play? Because one of the cases is before the courts right now. During the banking crisis, one of the most extraordinary features of the whole, the banking crisis in 2008 wrecked our economy and wrecked thousands of businesses. And not a single banker was ever jailed, nor a lawyer, nor an accountant. Now, you'd never guess how they all got off the hook. None of them had a legal duty to report the crimes that some of them must have seen, especially at Lloyds Bank.
Well, we're regularly reporting on the crimes of Lloyds Bank here at Castle Park, the business support unit. And actually, we were just reporting the other week on the massive amounts of signature fraud that's being moved around between various government departments, from Action Fraud to the City of London Police to the Serious Crime Squad. Who knows where this is the latest, but nobody actually wants to deal with it because it's such a hot potato. All these bankers have been forging signatures defrauding people of their property, Kevin.
Yeah, no, I followed the story and there's a special reason for it. I'm 76, and the guy who forced, only one person has ever put bankers from Lloyds in jail, and that was Tony Stansfeld. Tony got so incensed, he's ex-army, he was in the army with me, he got so incensed by what he saw that he became the crime commissioner for Thames Valley. And the investigation into the crooks in the Reading branch of Lloyds, the Lloyds TSB, had dropped the investigation. And it was Tony became the crime commissioner, went back and forced the police by, personal pressure of personality, forced the police to go back and charge these people. But only six out of thousands, and as you know, the other side of the story, there was fraud going on in Bristol. And nothing has been investigated, and only the cases he got behind. And then when he won them, the money was, the fines levied were given to the Treasury so that no other police force would have the money to go and investigate.
Well, that's right. And not even his own force would be properly compensated. So they would find a massive great hole in their budget, and they would learn that you don't do that again. The money is, they do say the money is a root of all evil, don't they? So the money is ruling the show there, as it seems to be here in Bristol too. Anyway, I thought maybe we'd go and have a listen now to a story which I found fascinating, and I think you'll like it too, Kevin. And this is about a documentary that came out in November last year. It was about the misuse, really, of the internet as an enormous great drain on our energy. For some reason, the Green Party here in Bristol, it was run by a lady called Eleanor Cumley, who's a physicist. And when I started discussing it with her, she went all quiet. She didn't really want to talk about it at all, which was the massive amount of energy being used by these big big tech companies, the data centers, and one does assume that because they believe they're so incredibly powerful, as we've seen over the last day or so with Facebook closing down all the news in Australia on its platform, that they can just censor stuff when they don't, you know, when a story comes to the door of Google, Facebook, or one of these massive, actually it's Amazon that owns a lot of these data centers, then they can just switch it off. And that's where they're coming from, these people. One does, I go back to, and if anyone remembers it from the 1980s, the series Max Headroom, where their reporter is every now and again he's running up against stories that involve the chairman of his own TV news company, at which point the camera gets switched off and he disappears. Yeah. You know? Anyway, so we're going to have a little listen now to an extract from this documentary that came out on as part of Dispatches back in November by Sophie Morgan, the investigative journalist Sophie Morgan. And it's really where here we hear about two things, really. One is the massive amounts of energy that these data centers are taking, which the Green Party don't really want to think about. They're saying that this is all great green stuff, you know. Oh, isn't it brilliant? We're all doing it on the internet. It's green. Well, actually, no, it's not green.
It's not green.
They're swallowing up vast amounts of energy. And the other side, which they look at here, which you very, very rarely see anyone talk about, is the amount of data that the 5G networks and the 4G networks, the mobile data networks, are swallowing up. And, of course, the 5G is much, much more than the 4G. So we're talking about a difference of something like 1,000 times more energy used to move your data around by mobile data than in the traditional like fiber broadband, which is extremely little, very, very tiny amounts of energy are used to move the data around in that way. And yet we don't hear anything from the Greens about the rollout of 5G. So let's have a listen now to this extract about data centres and 5G from the Dispatches documentary with Sophie Morgan from November 2020, entitled "Is Your Online Habit Killing the Planet?"
In the UK, data centres use between 2 and 3% of the grid. But to illustrate how much energy data centres can use, we looked at Europe's Silicon Valley, Ireland. Google, Facebook and Microsoft all have hyperscale data centres here. It's hard to get a figure, but Amazon alone may have as many as 9 sites in Dublin, and last year broke ground on a €1 billion data centre. Dispatches asked Ian Bitterlin, a data centre engineer, to calculate the potential energy future centres on this site could draw from the grid.
The new data centre campus they plan to build includes a new substation, a new place to connect to the grid. And they're building it at 220,000 volts, which means that the new data centre, it could easily be 400 megawatts. It's nearly the same power consumption as the entire city of Dublin.
And that's just for the plans at this site. Airgrid says data centres could consume as much as 27% of the Irish grid in the next 9 years. According to calculations Ian has done, he believes it could be as much as 41%.
This is off the scale. You can compare it to the UK. We intelligently guess that about 3% of the grid is consumed by data centres in the UK.
So can the Irish grid meet the demand that the data centres are putting on it?
So far, only just. If the plans expand, the answer appears to be no. They've got to expand the grid for the data centres. I don't know who's going to pay for the expansion of the grid.
Mm.
Yeah, it can only be the Irish government, which is the taxpayer.
A report by the Irish Academy of Engineering estimated that €9 billion is needed by 2027 to meet the increased demand for power from data centres in Ireland. Dispatches commissioned two experts to analyse the data from our two families and approximate the electricity cost of some of their activities.
Right, we've got a bit of a game to play. I'm going to ask you to guess roughly the energy used in certain situations. So, Gagan, you are on Amazon for 9 hours, 50 minutes a week. If everyone with a smartphone in the UK had the same habit for the equivalent energy consumed, how many households do you think you could power for a whole year? It's 1,500.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my
my God.
Did not expect that.
I know.
Don't watch.
John streams YouTube in his car on his way to work to listen to music. If John streamed just the audio, so say like using an app like Spotify or Apple Music, how much energy, percentage-wise, would he save? Bang on.
What, 90%?
90%. Yeah. You'd save the equivalent emissions per year of a 175-mile car trip.
170-mile car trip. Now, this what they're doing there is they're looking at the data streaming from a mobile in someone's car. Obviously, there are other ways of streaming to cars, and also there's a vast amount of energy used with these new, well, I say not new anymore, are they, smart TVs, many of which are also working on Wi-Fi. So, Kevin, there's vast amounts of energy being used here, and the Green Party are just completely burying their head in the sand.
And they're the same in Dublin. Let me tell you a tiny fact that most people aren't conscious of. There's a list of the largest and most important computers in the world. The United Kingdom ranks 9th. The Republic of Ireland ranks 7th. The Republic of Ireland has more supercomputers than the United Kingdom. And that's not a super... The biggest supercomputer in Japan, when they switch it on, the city nearby goes dark. So Dublin has enough supercomputers. If they're all switched on at the same time, it would be highly likely that the city would go dark.
Well, Martin is also regularly pointing out on this program that the way that Bitcoin works, you have to actually make loads of computers just buzz away doing effectively nothing, creating every Bitcoin, and each time you create one, it takes a bit more energy to do it. It almost seems like some sort of energy company Ponzi scheme, and we don't hear the Greens talking about that. So I don't quite understand why the Green Party is just totally turning a blind eye, and just environmentalists generally, people like Extinction Rebellion, to this massive rollout of particularly the 5G data networks, which are incredibly energy hungry.
I sort of looked into this. One of the reasons is that a lot of the kind of privacy advocates and green people get subsidies from companies like Amazon. So it's very unlikely they're going to bite the hand that feeds them. But there is an issue of where their subsidies come from.
That's true. I think the obvious thing to talk about now is the chat I had with George Butler earlier this week, which is to do with the snow and everything going on over in Texas. So we've got a little clip now, a chat with George Butler. For people that don't know, Texas is all frozen up. From the latest I heard from him last night was that they're due to have a thaw on Sunday. But the problem is that you've had loads of the wind generation that's now in Texas just simply can't cope with these low temperatures. And so he's spoke to me from a hotel which has taken in a whole load of he's one of the managers of the hotel, and they've taken in a whole load of local people in Texas who have ended up with no heat whatsoever in their homes, and so they've had to sort of congregate in this motel who has got a bit of electricity because they're quite close to the local electricity line that goes to the local hospital. So they've luckily got electricity. And I spoke to George Butler. He's, by the way, the host of a radio show called The Secret Truth every week in Austin, Texas. And he spoke to me last night about all this.
In the last 10 years or more, we've had a lot of wind power in West Texas develop. But it's been developed with subsidies by government, see? So these big turbines are like a couple of hundred feet tall to the actual turbine that is elevated off the ground by that much. And those propellers that are wind driven are 112 feet long. So what they've done is, here's the problem right now in Texas, and there's a few different facets to it. One is the this ERCOT, we think, could be have cut back to get the retail price of the energy up for a period of time. We've had diminished supplies of natural gas. We've had problems with that production, which is really our clean burning source of fuel here. And then the wind turbines and, of course, the solar, which is right now in the wintertime, the cloud cover is too much. But the wind turbines stopped turning. It got so cold and there was rain and snow that it coated some of the propellers, the blades of these wind turbines, to where that was one factor that kept the aerodynamics different. But the, one of the main things, and they haven't been talking about this, but anyway, up at the top where the actual turbine is, electrical turbine to generate the electricity, our gear is a gear system, okay? And this gearing system, it runs inside of an oil because there's a lot of heat generated. Well, when you get down to the temperatures that we've had, the viscosity of that oil gets real thick. And I think that's what stopped our wind turbines from turning more than any other factor. The blades, because they were coated with snow and ice, that probably did something also. But the thickness of the oil inside the gearbox, you could say, I think got so cold, and it just stopped the gears from being able to turn.
We think of Texas as a sort of the home of oil. I mean, have you not got anywhere you can burn some oil and make some power that way?
Well, what has happened, this green movement has come in and started pushing the wind and the solar. Now, during the summer, we've got a lot of sunshine in Texas. But during the winter, we have a lot of cloud cover, so that diminishes there. The wind stuff has been subsidized, so it's artificially subsidizing our overall energy, you could say, mix, you know. But we have a lot of natural gas. The problem with natural gas is the transportation of it to the source of consumption. And so we're building a lot of pipelines that there's a Permian Highway pipeline just completed from the Permian Basin, which is West Texas, to the Gulf Coast, where they can collect it and put it on freighters, on ships, to into Europe and Africa. That's what's going on in the Gulf Coast now. Like, it was snowing here in Central Texas earlier today. We're not used to these cold conditions. So when they started cutting back the power, people were inside their homes freezing to death. And so we have a motel investment here that we're taking in people and giving them, providing them free rooms. And we've got our mayor here, Connie Kassir, is just working with us really well on providing foods. And we've got churches that are donating, coming out and bringing us supplies so we can pass on to some of these people that need shelter, emergency shelter. And so they were almost driven out of their homes with no heat source, see. And most of the heat source in a lot of Texas now is electric.
Yeah, so that's where you haven't got wood. You're not burning wood or anything like that. I think, you know, in a way, it's just bad planning, isn't it, Kevin, that they become so reliable on these wind turbines. I think George is possibly right there when he's suggesting that the temperature, they're just simply not able to operate at these really low temperatures. If you've got a gear oil down to, you know, whatever it is, minus 20 Fahrenheit, it's going to start slowing the thing down until it can hardly move and the wind isn't able to actually turn the thing.
Yeah, that's brilliant what he said. Because the two things that capitalism, as we know it, is allergic to, one is planning and the other is cooperation. You can get a good system if you plan it right and if you get people to cooperate so that you have the right kind of backup if the weather gets really cold. But Texas is one of the places that generally doesn't believe in climate change and is not prepared for changes in the weather.
whether it's man-made. The issue in America is it man-made or is it nature? And my answer would be it doesn't matter. The figures suggest the weather is changing and it's not looking too cool. Actually, it's looking extremely cool in some places. But the figures over time suggest weather is much more volatile as it than it was. And scientists have various reasons for it, and a lot of them make sense.
Well, I mean, the obvious thing to do is to keep some of the old, whether it's oil-fired, coal-fired or whatever, power stations sitting there ready, so that when you get a cold spell like this, you know, they can come out of mothballs. You can maybe you can just fire the thing up once every 6 months and make sure it's still going, give it a bit of maintenance. Yeah. But this is the one thing that the capitalist-only classes and the idea that, you know, the whole business of utilities being run by business, big business, capitalist investors, just to me, what it's done is it's given all of the people who are of that kind of private sector type a great excuse to do nothing, because, you know, they get paid whatever happens, really, you know, because people need these services. They don't have to innovate. They just sit on their fat backsides and watch the money rolling in. And, of course, they don't want to spend any money on things like maintenance or planning, yeah, because there's no financial incentive from their shareholders to do so.
Yeah, raises costs. One of the curious things in the big climate thing is China. China is showing itself to be much more sensitive to the potential problems of climate change because it is China is conscious of the risks. Places like Texas are too gung-ho, and they're not conscious that even if it's not man-made, if the weather is just changing because the weather changes, there's going to be trouble. And you've got to plan for it. This is what you're saying. Exactly. You keep old oil-fired or gas-fired stations on standby. Cost a bit, but look what's happened to Texas.
I mean, what we're seeing really, I mean, the story we'll be talking about in a minute, which is to do with the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees is admitting that he's chums with Alexei Navalny, who was one of the people who was raping Russia back in the 1990s for the Western oligarchs who were destroying the country, pulling it apart, and Putin wrested it back from them. And of course, they don't like that. But, you know, what we've got is we've got a culture, a private interest culture, which is attacking, invading, infiltrating our public offices, that is to say, political parties, and even in our city here.
Yeah, well, the trouble is that's where the money is. And if it's a money culture, that's where the money will go.
Well, let's see what happens in our elections. But anyway, look, another related story, of course, is to do with Uber. Now, this is another private business that's coming in to take over wherever it can the taxi services around Britain. And that today it's been announced that, we're going to rein it in. It's going to have to behave like a proper company. Well, of course, this is really, I mean, in other words, to treat its employees as employees rather than as skivvies and a gig economy, you know, basically, you know, you've got no rights at all. And if you start to complain, we just get rid of you. That whole attitude which Uber brought in, they've got their market now, Kevin. So, of course, the government is going to allow Grant Shapps and the rest of them for them to and the courts to carry on as a more legitimate business. But they've used this whole thing of treating people, individuals, as freelancers and giving them no rights as a way to just capture the market. And now it seems that they may be going legit. But why have they been allowed to do that in the first place? I've read several stories now around the world, this is. And, of course, Uber is this Deutschland Uber company. They've actually had rapes. They've had even murders associated with the drivers of these Uber cabs because there's no proper regulation of them.
Yep. This is the brash capitalists, or what George Soros called bandit capitalism. This is bandit capitalism, and the person who called it that was George Soros. You know, George is a capitalist through and through, and one of the richest and most successful ever. But he was always blunt. I mean, he told the United Kingdom, if you when he kicked them out of the ERM. He said, if you go on with an independent currency, I will go on robbing you. That's what we do. That's what bandit capitalists do.
It does seem as if the whole, like literally our domestic politics and national politics, or say local politics here in Bristol, is all sliding towards a kind of mafia gangster rule by the rich, but also kind of lords of misrule. The idea is that they will tell us any old nonsense and then they will just do whatever they want. Anyway, so MI6 has also apologised today for gays who are prevented from being spies. So what do you make of that story? Because, I mean, I you know, certainly with my reading of the which we'll be hopefully hearing a clip from later, The Fifth Man, Roland Perry's book, looking at the Cambridge spies, most of them were gay. So, I mean, you do wonder whether actually you've got loads of gay and bisexual people in MI6, and they have been ever since, say, but you know, maybe the time between the First and Second World Wars.
There's the gay spies were all protected. They were all upper class. Some of them went to Eton. And gayness was tolerated if you were upper class. But if you were like poor old Turing, working class, you got the bounce. Now, the MI6's apology, a gay person is as capable of being a good spook as anybody else. And that's all that MI6 is recognising, belatedly. It's nice to see it, but it's belated. It takes the focus a bit away from the fact that the Cambridge spies were protected at the time because they were upper class. So, yeah, it's nice to see it, but it's belated.
Okay, so, I mean, what about this whole thing? They say, well, if you're gay or bisexual, this means that you could easily be compromised or blackmailed by the other side.
You mentioned somebody early on in the introduction, Sir Peter, was it Heyman?
Yeah, that's right, the deputy head of MI6, yeah.
Well, he was incredibly influential. He was effectively the de facto boss of the Ministry of Defence when Churchill was... Churchill, in his administration in the 50s, after he came back, was also Prime Minister and Defence Minister of Defence. And his key honcho in the Ministry of Defence was Heyman. Now, again, there's never been enough research. I would have a suspicion that when Heyman was based, as he was, in Germany, the Russians spotted him. I would believe he was being blackmailed or had been blackmailed. But certainly he was, just like the Cambridge spies, he was protected because he was upper class. But then that was what the Russians were acutely good at spotting.
Well, one of the things Roland Perry said in the interview I did with him, which it was available, I think I did it end of last year, actually. He was intimating that the Russians actually knew a tremendous amount about the paedophile rings in London, and that the Russian spies were gaining. Well, basically, they had a massive advantage over the British, because were being leaked information by Victor Rothschild, who was in turn the confidant of Peter Wright. So the problems that were going on within the British Secret Services that Peter Wright was pointing out, he was unbeknownst to him, he was going to a Russian spy to tell him all about them. So the Russians were way ahead of the Brits. Even during the war, Roland explains that Winston Churchill was finding out various secrets after Stalin was, because of Rothschild's pipeline to the Russians. And so in that sort of situation, with someone like Peter Heyman, I would imagine that the Russians, the KGB in London, had massive files on the various paedophiles, including Heyman. And he sexually abused boys at Dolphin Square, one of a group of paedophiles alleged to have sexually abused young boys at Dolphin Square. The Westminster paedophile ring, ex-MI6 spy Sir Peter Heyman's named. I mean, this sort of thing, I would imagine the Russians, if the Russians knew all about this, it's not surprising, is it, that the methods by which many of the Western journalists found out about Cold War stuff was, well, they would go to a contact and they would ask the contact, and then the new regime in Russia, whether that be after Glasnost, would hand them tidbits of information. But I think they may well be still holding a lot back about this Westminster paedophile ring, which seems to have apparently gone away. But I wonder, what do you make of this, Kevin? Because I know you've been involved in investigating this too over the years.
Well, my friend Mark Watts, unfortunately, picked the wrong horse, Nick. But my sense of the way it worked is the Russians specialized in looking out for people who were gay, especially before being gay was legalized. They would have studied, and they did study, and the studies were intense, the British upper class. That was their target. It was their target back in the 20s.
I seem to remember they all were given a copy of Anthony Sampson's The Anatomy of Britain and instructed to read it before they ever started even operating in Britain.
That's the upper level. Anthony Sampson's book was great, and he used Who Owns Britain in his reissue. But no, the targeting would have been much more finessed. They would have been looking out for subtle signals, you know, signals that a chap wasn't straight, that he was gay. And they would really focus in on that. And I think they did it in a much more comprehensive way than we understand. There's too much focus on the Cambridge spies. I think there were spies in Oxford as well. This is what the Russians looked for. You know, how could they miss? How could they only find five?
Well, I mean, this does make me wonder why there's all this Russophobia, is because those in power who are criminals know that the Putin has got all these cards up his sleeve still if he wanted to use them.
They've refined them. They have refined them a lot. Far from it. It's not just because Putin's ex-KGB. All the intelligence services, ours and theirs, have refined the situation. They all do mass surveillance. But the psycho-surveillance and the analysis of the databases they create from the surveillance is very advanced. And again, the British media don't write anything about it. And it's quite widely known what they're up to. A key book was published, wait for this, in 2008, in which James Bamford, the very eminent and talented American ex-serviceman journalist, he pointed out all the evils that the National Security Agency were up to, and that's 12 years ago. Now, anything the National Security Agency were doing, the Russians were doing as well, and the Chinese.
Well,
those are the key ones.
Let's get up to today, because we've got the main sort of thing going on, ding-donging between us and the former Soviet Union, is this whole business with Alexei Navalny. Now, he's been sentenced to 3.5 years, I believe. He's known to be very chummy with a chap called Khodorkovsky, who was booted out of Russia. A lot of financial contacts with him. But what do you make of Navalny and the so-called poisoning in his underpants with this amazing stuff, Novichok, which may or may not exist? According to my sources, it may even just have been a Russian a bit of information that was given, which is a chemical that doesn't actually work, but in order to see if someone was passing the formulas to the West, which it wasn't, which they were, by the way. They were found out, yes, they were passing them to the West, and they were arrested as a result. But anyway, what do you make of the whole Navalny case? We've now got this guy called Bellingcat, who seems to be one of the main people who's been outing his critics mainly.
The stuff Bellingcat have come up with is absolutely amazing. They found the grandmother or the aunt or something of one of the people alleged to have done the bad deed in Salisbury. But what our media have never written, there are two things our media and have not disclosed, and I feel they should have. All the news is that the Russians have this nerve gas. so do Port and Down, and so do South Africa now, and Israel. I think we should have been told, and so does the United States. But all the focus was, this is, and the inference was, this is unique, it's unique to the Russians. It's not. So we weren't told. And the second thing we weren't told is that the chap who was attacked, what's it called, the Sergei thing in Salisbury.
Skripal
had gone back to business, and he was selling Russian secrets. We weren't told anything about that. You know, it was glossed over. He was kind of in the private security business. He was a lot further in than that.
Yeah, but I think maybe the main point about the Skripal story is he was trying to go back to Russia. He'd written a letter to Putin asking him to be pardoned so he could return. He'd had enough of working for MI6 here in the UK. So, of course, this could quite easily, since we haven't actually had statements from Skripal himself at all, nope. It could quite easily be that the British have just decided, well, no, he's not going back to Russia, and he's going to stay here. We're going to, you know, keep a very close eye on him, and he's definitely not going home. But we've got to come up with a story in order to cover that fact. But anyway, look, getting back to Navalny, do you think, I mean, we're hearing a lot more about this guy. When I started looking into him, it's quite clear he was one of the people raping Russia back in the 1990s during the time of the Yeltsin era, where basically asset stripping companies and selling them off. And he himself was one of the most corrupt people in the country. It's not surprising that he doesn't have much support. Even the BBC last weekend admitted that there weren't many people at this anti-Putin Navalny rally. So what do you make of this guy, Kevin?
As I say, I haven't had time to look into his background. I had a fair bit on my plate recently, but it's curious, and it looks as if the West is trying to use him to pull off a coup in Russia, like the one in Ukraine, the Velvet Revolution.
Well, they're going to have much luck. They might pull it off on TV, but not anywhere else. And it's only really the television, I think. And this is why I'm so disgusted with the journalism around this, is that this guy has got no political power in Russia at all. He's a has been from the 1990s. But he's being put forward constantly as, you know, the main opposition to Putin. Well, he is only on the pantomime television news programs that we have here in the West.
Yeah.
He's not in any way really a threat to Putin. He's an annoyance, and he's now been locked up for corruption. But anyway, I'll put a link up to the some of the stuff about him, which is not written from a Channel 4 News or a Western media point of view, about who is Alexei Navalny. But we're going to hear now from one of his best chums, who happens to be our Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees, who came out last weekend. I was actually stunned to see, talking about what a lovely guy he is and how hard he fought corruption in Russia. Well, Mr. Marvin Rees, I have to tell you, you have turned truth totally on its head there, because he was raping the country and stealing its resources. He certainly wasn't trying to uncover corruption. So let's have a listen to Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees, concerned about what he calls his brave friend Alexei Navalny, speaking on Sky News.
Well, it's called the Yale World Fellows Program. Every year they take 15 or so people from around the world, and you go to university, you spend about 4 or 5 months there. And when I arrived, that's where I met Alexei. We were neighbours. Because we had children, our families were with us, we were in the same block, so we lived next door to each other, along with Ricardo Taran from Nicaragua and Lumumba Diaping from Southern Sudan. I'm just the mayor of Bristol who's met a man who has committed his life to exposing fraud in Russia that's taken money out of the pockets of millions upon millions of people and putting it into the hands of a few well-positioned people at the top. And that's the man I know, and I'm horrified about what's happening to him. I'm very concerned about his family, but I know it's not just me. I know there are many thousands of people, but certainly in the small group I know, many hundreds of people around the world who are also concerned and just dismayed about what's going on in Russia.
Yeah, I mean, do you think the Kremlin have used Navalny's time at Yale to push that narrative that he is a puppet of the West?
Without question. It was in November when we were at university, Alexei coming to our common room and was talking about a new fraud he just uncovered with the Eastern Siberian Pacific oil pipeline. I think it was about $4 billion. And a number of the Yale fellows, Ana Paula, who worked on drug policy in Mexico, so she was at the front end of things as well. Ana Paula, Lumumba, Sergei Legodinsky, they were all saying, Alexei, it might not be wise for you to go back. When you're exposing $4 billion of fraud, that's very, very serious. It's not going to be safe. Alexei's point was, if I don't go back, they are going to say, I am a puppet of the West. They're going to say, I've been at Yale, I'm associated with the CIA. They're going to spread all these rumors. And so he went back in the face of all the warnings from his fellow world fellows about the threats to his own and his family safety. And you just have to admire that. A brave man, he knew what was coming. And what's happened is exactly what he said would happen. I just hope that people can see through it for what it is.
Well, I hope that people can see through what you just said, Bristol Mayor, so-called Labour Mayor Marvin Rees, for what it is, which is a load of nonsense. Yale is the headquarters also, isn't it, of the Skull and Bones, Kevin? That's where, yeah. That secret society, which in fact, on the podcast of this programme, you should hear Anthony Sutton chatting about what he thinks of the Skull and Bones secret society from Yale University. But look, the main point is this guy is one of Khodorkovsky's little gophers. And these are the oligarchs that tried to destroy Russia. Really, the plan was to sell it all off, everything, and then it to be just owned like the West is owned by finance and big business, like the BBC is owned, and the rest of these organizations, that the finance and big business just buys its way in to everything. So anything that's articulate, intellectual and critical of big business is just bought up and shut down. And this is the kind of guy Alexei Navalny is. And actually, I wonder whether this is the kind of guy our Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees is too.
Right. Your Bristol Mayor saying anything else, Tony?
Not really. No, he's just saying he's a lovely guy. He's my chum. He's my friend. And he's not really talking about the fact that he's one of the people who was sent in to rape the country in the 1990s, along with the oligarchs who were trained up in Switzerland, where, by the way, Khodorkovsky has returned to now. So basically Putin's attitude to all of this was, I think, a very mature, sensible, and I'd like to see that attitude in every single country where these oligarchs try and take hold, which is to say to them, well, you're gangsters, I'm a gangster, but I'm actually president too, and you can do your gangster stuff, but if you even so much as think about trying to take power from the Kremlin, then you're out on your ear hole. And he's done a very good job, for example, with Berezovsky, who is the head of the oligarchs. He turned the tables on him, because Berezovsky thought that Putin was going to be as president, his little puppet. And literally weeks after he took over in 2000, Putin turned the tables on Berezovsky. He dug up some old charges against him, which had been quashed by Yeltsin, about the privatization of Aeroflot, the national airline, and which was all showed how crooked it was, and he got this money through Switzerland. And he said phoned up Berezovsky and said, well, look, mate, I haven't been able to stop this prosecution and I can't stop it. But what I will say is, if you get out of the country tonight, I'll do what I can to stop the prosecution. And of course, Berezovsky very sensibly got on the next plane out of Russia to London, and he never came back. And that was how Putin took back control of Russia from the oligarchs. Of course, that sent a very strong message to the other oligarchs. Since Berezovsky was the top guy, and others have tried to take out Putin and take out the Russian government in succeeding years, but failed. So going back to these Yale World Fellows, this is an amazing thing, because this is one of obviously both Navalny, Alexei Navalny and Marvin Rees were a part of these. And every year the program selects 16 World Fellows to reside at Yale for the fall semester to study and share their knowledge and expand their networks. Well, it's interesting that this is coming from the university, which is the headquarters of the Skull and Bone Society, which was formed by the Russell Trust, which made its money from the opium trade. and it's also known as the Brotherhood of Death. So Marvin Rees was tapped up as a young man to be one of these people. And one has to ask, why is it and how is it that somebody like our mayor gets put on this conveyor belt to power? It's been compared very much to the Rhodes Scholarships at Oxford, where people just who haven't actually passed exams or anything to get into a university just get told you're going to be getting a world class university education. So you're basically being put on to do PPE or something like a kind of prime minister's degree, even though you haven't actually earned your way onto that course. We're going to give you this opportunity. And who gets a chance to do that? Someone with lots of money. What do you make of all of this, Kevin? Am I over egging the pudding? I think not at all.
I mean, it's how our system runs here. And very few, particularly from the West, note the intense similarity between America and Russia. Both countries are run by oligarchs, just different oligarchs. But American public life is governed by money. Russian public life is governed by money. They're almost identical.
We're gonna end part one now. We've managed to do almost all of that without talking about COVID at all, which I think is a great achievement. And we're going to go on in part two to look at the latest to do with the so-called pandemic, whether it really is or not, of course, is another question. Before that, we're going to hear some music. Now, I just thought, simply because, I mean, we heard it last year, but it's one of the best, I think, songs to do with the pandemic. It's called COVID-19, the Musical by the group. And I'll say that in a minute. But anyway, so thanks very much to former Sunday Times rich journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill. He'll be back with me after this as we take our weekly look around the world. But right now, it's COVID-19, the Musical. Frankie Goes to Nowhere.
No vax refuses. No vax. the year. They won't forget what they see. Corruption and lie after lie surrounding COVID-19.
Folks in and making sure we are all safe.
Well, 7 billion people.
Oh, thanks, Bill. If the media was controlled by journalists and not by marketing and advertising people, that would probably be number one. But it isn't, because it's the wrong story. Anyway, I'm joined by former Sunday Times Rich List journalist Kevin Carhill. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. With me, Tony Gosling and Kevin Carhill. The Fox News every Sunday has become required viewing in the battle to crush investigative journalism like this show in the West. If you want to see anything really investigative journalism, these are the guys to watch. Steve Hilton, we've got a report from him, the latest one, in a minute, looking at the lab origins of the coronavirus put together by Steve Hilton. He's a former advisor to David Cameron, now working on Fox News. And also, they're killing the high street. Are the Tory party killing capitalism? That's one of the writers for Conservative Woman talking to me about that. And also, the Stern Gang, the Jewish terrorist plot to assassinate Winston Churchill in April 1945. But what about JFK and Bobby Kennedy? Does the Israeli mafia also have a hand in or even direct those assassinations? A new but instantly banned from BitChute French documentary, Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers, subtitled JFK and 9/11, 50 Years of the Deep State, by the French writer and journalist and obviously filmmaker too, Laurent Guillenot. So that's what we've got to come. We've got what we've got in store. Also, a little clip from Dennis Wheatley talking about he was a psychological warfare officer, deception planner in the Second World War, and one of the greatest novelists, historical novelists particularly, now buried in more ways than one, Dennis Wheatley, on how the forces of darkness are threatening to come out on top. But he's actually warning about that in a similar sort of way as George Orwell was, of course, and how the Israelis finally, according to Tim Cohen, may eventually turn back to God. I think a fascinating idea there. About time too, I think, since their apartheid policies that they're pursuing particularly in Gaza and the West Bank, are pretty horrific. Anyway, so look, let's start, Kevin, with Steve Hilton. I think we'll just have a listen to it and see what you make of it afterwards. Yeah. His programme, The Next Revolution, I'd never come across it before, but it's great to see somebody actually bothering to go into the World Health Organization's Peter Daszak, who went over there to investigate himself, basically, and then found nothing. He spent his time looking down caves, and, of course, he didn't find anything that he'd been up to in the lab there. So, of course, this is the audacity of the mafia, the international criminal Bilderberg mafia, that they will go and actually take over the organisations that are supposed to be doing the investigations. And thank God somebody somewhere, in this case Fox News' Steve Hilton, has actually managed to find out what they're up to. So let's have a listen now to The Next Revolution, a clip from last Sunday.
With every week that goes by, the behaviour of the two most powerful governments in the world, the Chinese regime and our own government here in America, feeds more suspicion that they are responsible, unintentionally, as we've made clear, for the biggest global catastrophe in 100 years. We owe it to the memory of the 2 million who've died, their grieving families and friends, the billions of people hurt by this pandemic, to make sure we have a full, forensic, open and credible investigation into its origins so we can learn the lessons that will help prevent the next one. But instead, we have this, the pathetic World Health Organization probe, a year late, wrapping up the China stage of their investigation after just 4 weeks, with literally half that time spent in quarantine. They asked the Chinese regime for data on 147 patients with early cases of COVID. They didn't get it. They asked for access to data from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. They didn't get it. The lab samples, the viruses they were working on, the contents of the freezers, the databases, the details that could actually help confirm or rule out the hypothesis that, as we have shown you week after week, is by far the most credible, that the virus accidentally leaked from the Wuhan lab. The WHO didn't get that evidence, they didn't see that evidence, and yet still, they made this totally outrageous announcement.
The findings suggest that the laboratory incident hypothesis is extremely unlikely, and to explain the introduction of the virus into the human population, it was very unlikely that anything could escape from such a place.
That is literally not true. As we have shown you, there have been a number of leaks from such a place. During the SARS epidemic, two researchers studying that virus in a lab in China became infected and sparked an outbreak. A researcher in Singapore was also infected with SARS, and he wasn't even studying it. Other people in his lab were. The Wuhan lab itself was inspected and considered a risk for exactly this kind of leak. And remember, it was leaks from such a place that prompted the Obama administration's ban on gain-of-function virus research. But worse than just ruling out the one explanation for which there's most evidence, an accidental lab leak, this week, the WHO actively spread debunked misinformation and Chinese propaganda. They said the pandemic could have been started in the Wuhan wet market. But Chinese epidemiologists debunked that theory over a year ago. They studied the first 41 coronavirus hospitalizations and found that the first case had no link to other cases of people who'd visited the wet market. Then the WHO said the pandemic may have started with frozen food from India or something. My God, how could anyone say that with a straight face when the coronavirus causing the pandemic that started in Wuhan is 96% identical to the bat coronavirus the Wuhan Institute collected from a mine 1,000 miles away where 3 people died from a SARS-like illness years before, a virus that was already in the Wuhan lab and nowhere else on Earth. The WHO statements last week were so outrageous that even the head of the WHO then backtracked.
Some questions have been raised as to whether some hypotheses have been discarded. Having spoken with some members of the team, I wish to confirm that all hypotheses remain open and require further analysis and studies.
Exactly. And surely the hypothesis that should be getting the most further study is the one that's by far the most likely, the one we've been telling you about, the hypothesis that starts with our own NIAID commissioning gain-of-function virus research despite the Obama administration's ban, in the form of three payments totaling more than $1.8 million while the ban was in place to EcoHealth Alliance, run by Peter Daszak, who then subcontracted the NIAID grant to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. We know what they did for the NIAID because it's detailed in a 2017 paper tied to the original grant. Peter Daszak and Shi Zhengli, head of the Wuhan Institute's Infectious Diseases Unit, are listed as co-authors on this progress report, which specifically describes gain-of-function experiments.
Steve Hilton there on the Next Revolution on Fox News last Sunday. Kevin, what do you make of the investigation they're doing? I mean, to me, it's the only thing. We've been following this right since the very beginning when we announced back in January. Sorry, first week in February when we were still on FM, the virus that was going through at the time, it was just really in China, that the genome had been pulled apart and the Indian virologists at the virology department at New Delhi University were saying that it looked as if it was man-made with the spike proteins from SARS and spike proteins from AIDS, which they had looked at. I mean, you know, this is amazing stuff. They use this thing called X-ray crystallography, a bit like the electron microscope, to go and take photographs so they can basically sequence the genes in the virus that the virus is using. So once they actually get its genetic makeup, they can pull this all apart. And they did that last week in January in China and published it for the world to see so that the world could help analyze what it was. It immediately came out as looking like it was made in a lab. We know there's this top level lab in Wuhan. And Steve Hilton has been really tracking down what he believes is going on there. And he's not like Trump was trying to blame the Chinese. He's saying it's this Pentagon cover program run by Peter Daszak at EcoHealth Alliance. And it was fascinating to hear Tedros Adhanom, who's the boss of the World Health Organization there, actually sounding like he was lying when he was saying, I mean, maybe the guy's quite honest and he's just being told and he knows it's not true. But then he kind of backtracked, didn't he? So initially they announced that it was definitely nothing to do with the lab. And then, literally within hours, it was announced that the World Health Organization boss is saying all hypotheses are still open.
Okay, two quick ones. Steve Hilton is so typical of Fox News. He shouts. The second thing he didn't mention, and this is a case of where the absent information might be very important, he didn't mention that the security classification and sign-off for the Wuhan lab was granted by the Pentagon twice. They were doing work, in effect, for the Pentagon. Now, there's one thing you know about human organizations that I do. They always make mistakes. I would have an innate suspicion that people fiddling with very obscure viruses in labs, that's not safe. Period. But the security sort of guarantees on the Wuhan lab were twice granted by the Pentagon, as I say, because they were doing work for the Pentagon, which sort of goes back to Steve's theory that it was American financed research. Yeah. From what I know of it, the research was financed by the Pentagon.
Fascinating, isn't it? So this is really a covert biological weapons program. I mean, very much like, I don't know about here in the UK, and we're going to be talking about nukes in a minute, but certainly the Germans took the German nuclear bomb development, which is kind of supposed not to have happened, but clearly did happen. If you look at some of the stuff that's come out around 2016, 2017 about it, that was all taken away from Albert Speer at the Armaments Ministry, and it was put under a civilian cover. So that's what they do. They just make sure that anything that they shouldn't be doing, and they know they shouldn't be doing, is given an amazing cover, a bit like Peter Daszak. This guy who's in charge of this program has got this fluffy EcoHealth Alliance charity, which some have said was linked back to Gerald Durrell's charity, that it was taken over by him. But we'll maybe have more about that next week. Anyway, Steve Hilton, let's hear the second part of this report now, Kevin. Mm. And here it is. I mean, this is one of the things that annoys me about Bristol right now, is I've got Sandy Hoare Ruthven, who's standing for mayor for Bristol from the Green Party, refusing to talk to me, refusing to get back for the last month, asking him to come on and have a chat with us. I mean, I don't know quite what questions he expects me to ask. Maybe the questions about how much energy 5G is going to use, how much energy the data centres are going to use, and whether he actually cares about it at all, or whether he has got his fingers crossed, hoping that the BBC and ITV and various other media in the city won't ask him those questions. So let's have a listen now to, I mean, because, you know, this is what we're getting now, is we're getting a whole load of public officials who should be publicly accountable, who are behaving as if they're corporate bosses of Exxon or something, and they can just pick and choose which media they speak to. And this I find extremely disturbing and incredibly anti-democratic and anti-journalistic. So I think it would be interesting to see if any of these people like Marvin Rees and Sandy Hoare Ruthven, the Labour Party and the Green Party, do come and have a chat with us, because we would like to know a bit about these things. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to the second part of this report with Steve Hilton, and you'll see why in a minute I was talking about the mayor candidates here in Bristol, because he, like me, has been completely stonewalled by the people who should be answering questions about his report.
For the fourth week running, NIH refused our request for Dr. Fauci, Dr. Collins, or anyone from the NIH or NIAID to answer our questions. What does that tell you? If they had a good answer, if they could rule out the hypothesis that the pandemic started with research they commissioned, which accidentally leaked from the lab they paid to do the work, don't you think they'd want to shout that from the rooftops? What does it tell you that the WHO investigation so ludicrously rushed to rule out the most likely origin? It's obvious now that the WHO investigation is inadequate. It must be reconstituted. For a start, Peter Daszak, whose presence as the only US representative is the very definition of conflict of interest, must be replaced. The Biden administration made a huge fuss about rejoining the WHO, so now make a fuss to get a proper investigation. But in any case, President Biden doesn't need to wait for the WHO. Right now, tonight, Biden has full access to information that could shed crucial light on all this. U.S. intelligence has established that workers at the Wuhan lab came down with COVID symptoms before the first reported cases. U.S. intelligence has a, quote, growing body of evidence that the virus leaked from the Wuhan lab. The president was at the NIH on Thursday, and Peter Doocy asked him about this.
Mr. President, any interest in punishing China for not being truthful about COVID last year?
I mentioned you're getting all the facts.
Well, that's great, but the question is, what is Biden doing to get all the facts? By putting pressure on the WHO over its investigation, but more immediately, by releasing the information that we know the president has about the origins of the pandemic. Follow us at Steve Hilton X and at Next Rev FNC, and please share this message and keep the pressure up.
Right, so that's Steve Hilton, and it's amazing how he's been completely stonewalled there. Joe Biden, or whoever that was, just saying, oh, we're going to get to the facts. Well, he's not really getting to the facts at all, Kevin.
No, but do you know what? Going back to when the whole thing started in Wuhan, can you recall it? The first thing I noticed was it was just like a classic bureaucratic screw-up here. The bureaucrats around Wuhan didn't want to admit they had a problem, and they hadn't admitted. Remember the doctor they threw out of the hospital and that, and who's since died? Classic bureaucratic stuff. We know better than you. You're a doctor. Go away. And it became politicized. And the politics looked terribly like bad bureaucracy, didn't react fast enough, and then they're trying to cover up. So Steve is right about bits of it. There's a cover-up. The bureaucrats in Wuhan don't want to admit they screwed it up. The Pentagon doesn't want to admit and be brought into it because it sank it. What's the word? sanctioned or gave permission.
Well, it commissioned this research, really, Kevin.
Sorry?
The Pentagon commissioned this research.
Originally, as far as I remember, yeah.
What do you make of the basics on this? So is it China? Is it the Americans? Was it leaked deliberately or not?
No, it's none. I don't think it's any of these. A lot of nations, it's not merely the Chinese and the Americans, are pursuing studies. I think they shouldn't be pursuing studies because eventually a test tube will break in a lab and something nasty will come loose. But what all this covers up is the overwhelming evidence that there are a lot of nasty viruses about waiting to jump species barriers, i.e. from animals to humans.
Yeah, but what's going on there is Peter Daszak is helping them out. He's making sure they do jump those barriers.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it really looks like. As I say, I'm not totally convinced by Seafield, but he's got a point, and it's an important point, and he shouldn't be shut down for saying it. But the real threat to humanity is coming from nature itself. And the reason it's coming from nature is because we are making such huge changes. There was something on Attenborough recently where I think it was Indonesia, all the fruit bats moved because, you know, somebody burnt down the forest. And the fruit bats moved into a new environment in Indonesia. And the next thing you have diseases in Indonesia that no one had ever seen before.
Yeah, well, maybe it was Peter Daszak was hanging around there too. No, I mean, I just have to quite strongly disagree with you, Kevin. I think the real danger here is that we've got covert programs going on to research these biological weapons when actually there should be, and there is, a complete ban on all this activity.
We are 100% together on this. No, we're not at odd points. There are enough dangerous viruses around without making more, and these weapon programs should never be permitted on planet Earth.
What about the role of our own port and down? It was interesting, wasn't it, that the Queen and Prince Charles, I think, oh, it's Prince William, went to visit that during the first lockdown, or maybe the second lockdown, as their first actual public engagement, if you can call it that. I suppose it's a very private public engagement. After the first lockdown, important down is where they decided to go.
Well, this is, you know, this is the kind of public fantasy we are fed here. We're not told what important down does, and the royals are kind of wheeled up so that nobody asks. It would be rude, you know, to suggest the Queen's rocking around in an extremely dangerous environment. Because they're doing all sorts of things they shouldn't be doing in an ethical universe.
I mean, the other thing there is that Prince Charles has got this amazing role as the overseer of all of the security services. Of course, I mean, this is MI5, MI6 and GCHQ, and there are probably others beside. But anyway, Prince Charles is now the sort of colonel-in-chief of all of them. Whereas actually that was proved disastrous in the Second World War. The one unit of MI6, M section, which the King commanded, that's King George VI, was the one which was used to get Martin Bormann out of Berlin right at the very end of the Second World War and basically take all the loot of Nazi Germany and use it for the international mafia. That whole operation was a completely horrendous thing to have done. It's quite possible that the guy, Commander Harold Golding, who'd been involved in training the commandos, when his commandos were used and he found out what they'd been used for, he, just about 3 weeks after the end of the war, he dropped dead, even though he was a DSO, because maybe he'd been kicking up a bit of a fuss about it. Who knows? But, you know, the idea that they've got the royal family as colonels-in-chief, commanders-in-chief of all the secret services, surely they should be being run by the Defence Ministry, not by the Crown.
They should be, you know, under democratic control, not under the control of people who are not democratically accessible, which they are not.
Not many people seem to really know about that. But anyway, look, I thought we'd be, since we got you on, Kevin, we'll take a little excursion away from COVID for a minute and have a listen to Roland Perry, who I interviewed before Christmas. I think is absolutely terrific book he's done, The Fifth Man. Well, first of all, what do you think about his conjecture that Victor Rothschild was the fifth man after Burgess, MacLean, Philby and Blunt? And then there was an attempt to pin it on somebody called Cairncross.
Correct, yeah.
It looked like it was very unlikely it was really him. What do you make of Roland Perry, and what do you make of this idea of Lord Victor Rothschild, peer of the realm, super spy for Stalin?
This is not the first time Victor Rothschild has been put in the frame. He was a funny figure. He floated around with fingers in lots of pies. And certainly before Cairncross was really fronted up, Victor Rothschild was the fifth man candidate. There were suspicions about him all the time. They were never proved.
Go off on one about this really is because the institution that I joined in 1989, I think it was 88 or 89, the BBC, I could see what had happened after the previous year, that the Director General, Alistair Milne, had been sacked, that we could see all around us the whole institution slowly crumbling. This guy, John Burt, who was put in charge as Director General, slowly but surely turning it into some kind of... they were using people like Odgers, you know, to appoint staff. So the same sort of people as you would get in a corporate boardroom as maybe non-executive directors who were easily pliable, would do what they were told. These were kind of coming in as managers and producers and God knows what. And there was also a very pro-Israeli slant to many of the people that we saw arriving in the production offices, in the newsrooms and things like that. There were characters like they're there beforehand, but this became the kind of dominant strain in the BBC. And I put this down to 100% to Victor Rothschild. In fact, Marmaduke Hussey, who was the chairman of the BBC at the time, whose wife was the chief lady-in-waiting to the Queen. And there were questions about the Diana documentary, which happened around about the same time on Panorama, that they had to do it without telling anybody in the senior management of the BBC that this was going to be broadcast, because they know it would get straight back to the Queen and that she would block it. And that's how ballsy they were back in those days, in the 1990s even. But Marmaduke Hussey explains that it was Victor Rothschild who approached him, asking him if he could sack the Director General. And he put that in his autobiography. I think it was called Chance Governs All, which, of course, is a complete load of nonsense. He was pulling strings behind the scenes in the British establishment to basically shut down the BBC. And we're seeing the results now, which is this appalling propaganda arm of number one, Big Pharma, and number two, the government. So let's have a listen now to Roland Perry talking about the bomb and Victor Rothschild. And particularly what he was saying was that Victor was involved in a lot of the technical stuff that was going on over here in the UK. And he was privy to almost everything, and he was seen as above suspicion, but all the time he was passing secrets to the Russian. But what about the atomic bomb? Who was really behind it? Because I always thought maybe that the British sort of started the thing, but most of the hard work and the technical stuff was done by the Americans. But he says no.
Blunt was MI5. Rothschild got him in. Rothschild got Burgess into the system. That's the intelligence system during the war. And he got Blunt in. His recommendations got them in. He was a double eminence grise, if you like. He had enormous power. He was a Labour Lord. He was in the Labour Party, who had enormous pull. He was greatly respected. He was a polymath. Remember, he was an outstanding scientist. He had a tremendous record at Cambridge. And he had a great brain. I mean, too clever by half, I think, because he thought he could get away with it by being very, very clever, and he was. But he didn't over time. He made slips over time, obviously, but he was kind of doing too much. But he got those guys in. He himself was an MI5 operative before the war. He operated a little bit after war, but he mainly worked loosely for MI6 after the war. That is Bond, right? For the people out there, James Bond. He wasn't James Bond, but that was British spying outside the UK. MI5 is inside. What he did was he got himself to be the MI5 inspector of all research institutes in the UK during the war. What was he doing? Oh, he was saying, well, we can't have the Germans, our enemy, getting in to all these research facilities, whether they be microbiology, whether they be in the nuclear area, and he was above all this stuff. What he would do is he'd go in and he'd quiz they'd hear that Lord Rothschild was coming to inspect their research facility. Everyone would run around wetting themselves that the great Lord was coming, and he would then interrogate the scientists. I interviewed plenty of them, one in particular, a great Mark Oliphant, Sir Marcus Oliphant, who invented radar and was also big in nuclear physics as well, and the bomb. And he interviewed him, and of course they spilled everything because the great Lord was wanting to know what was going on in the lab or what was this equipment for. And he nicked a bit of equipment actually from Oliphant. That's another story. And then sent it back after he'd sent the copy of it off to the Russians. But that was his job. So he got inside. He knew all the research. So he was able to push it all over to the Russians, and he would give it to Blunt. And this is during the war, or Burgess. They were the two main recipients of it. They would meet their control, their KGB control, who would be in or usually inside the embassy, the Russian embassy, the Soviet embassy, and they would send it off in a diplomatic bag to Moscow. So the Russians were right up with everything that the Brits were doing on all these areas of research. That was
hang on though, because the bomb was surely, most of that was all being done over in the States. It wasn't all technology. No.
Enormous amount being done in Britain. Don't ever kid yourself that you weren't at the forefront. The British were at the forefront of that area. Yes, the Americans got it off the ground first, but they weren't the leaders. They didn't have the leading scientists that you did en masse working on it. So it was a combination of stuff. They were working together. Rothschild was one of the conduits for that at one point, passing information to the Americans. So it was you were equally proficient at developing the bomb, if not better. And I could go. There's a book in it, but I'm not bothering about it. There's no doubt you were big. So if they stole from you in certain areas and passed it to the Russians, that was just as good as getting it, because the Americans were giving. There was no. There was no suspicion about the Brits having major spies within their organisation in the establishment at that point in World War II. There was after World War II when the defection, obviously the Brits are flying off to Moscow. Oh, I'm out of here. I'm a double agent. The Americans are going, what? I knew that guy. You know, I knew him. I trained him. I was with him. But they were very, very upset about the British after the war, in the Cold War. But during the war, we were passing, and I say the royal we, the British were passing on all their information on the bomb to the Brits. And a lot of it, I would say the British had a bigger impact on the development of the bomb than the Americans, if you part it down.
So that's Roland Perry there. Kevin, what do you make of that?
Yeah, again, he's got it, I think, about right, because what happened, the atomic bomb project in Britain was called Tube Alloys. And during the war, obviously, the UK was very stretched, and you were going to need a huge industrial complex to produce the bomb materials.
Okay, well, I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but again, that's civilian cover, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we sent all the stuff, the plans, secrets, and everything else to the United States. They built up the Manhattan Project, and then they shut us out. The United States passed laws in 1945, I think, closing all two-way flow of nuclear stuff. They cut the United Kingdom out. And it wasn't for reasons of espionage. They had got sufficient stuff from us to make the bomb, and they made it. And they didn't need us anymore, so we got cut out.
Well, yeah, but so, we went on to make it. I think it was largely Winston Churchill that made sure that there was a British atomic bomb as well. Anyway, let's go and have a listen to part two from Roland Perry.
Yeah,
where he talks about the main issue, really, with Victor Rothschild, was his involvement in the creation of Israel. And I asked him, I said, well, look, you're writing all this stuff. Didn't you get accused, Roland, of anti-Semitism?
when I came back from Russia, I remember talking to Jack Grossman, who's Jewish, of course, he's now gone. And I said to Jack, look, I've got to tell you, it's Victor Nathaniel Mayer Rothschild of the Rothschild family. And he looked at me and said, you've got to go for it. You know, he was red. And I, look, it's people out there saying, oh, well, he must, why didn't he go on his own evidence? Why does he have to tell his best mate who was a Jew about it? I wanted to hear it from Jack, who I respected enormously, that it was okay to go for it. I was sensitive enough to understand what it would mean to out Rothschild as a major spy. And I have no doubts on the information I got from the Russians and also MI6 and others. And, yeah, there was a bit of anti-Semitism. There was anti-Semitism within the Russians themselves in terms of Rothschild. They didn't like him. The head, Modin's boss, was a guy called Ivan the Terrible Serov, right? The terrible inverted commas. He hated Rothschild, but realised what a terrific spy he was for them, and that's where the confirmation evidence came from. His hidden diaries, which were released a few years ago, just recently, and I got hold of and was able to use. And MI6 had as well. Everyone had them. It hasn't been much. There hasn't been much public activity on it. If you look up on the net, you'll probably find something on Ivan Serov's declarations in his diaries, but he was a brute. He was Stalin's henchman, and he didn't like Rothschild because Rothschild was a very, I mean, you know, it goes without saying, a brilliant mind, a Jew, and he was very independent. Even though the KGB thought they had him, he was a very, very independent character.
So, I mean, and Victor Rothschild's life spans the creation of the State of Israel. Do you think he had a role in that?
Huge. Number one. Number one, he got the Russians to vote for the development of the State of Israel. Australia did. We had a good affinity with the Israelis, and we backed it. But if you look at the roll call of the United Nations, it stood up and said, we want Israel developed and so forth in 1948, this was. Australia was in, Russia was in, and that was Rothschild's payback. He just told Stalin, you have to do it, effectively, because we've done so much for you, you do it. And, you know, it was tied up in the anti-Nazi thing, they'll be able to use all that. So, yeah, Victor created their entire intelligence network. I have that in the book. They're pretty effective. They've just killed that Iranian, I would say. I don't know, but it looks like they murdered those, they've killed two of them now who are developing nuclear weapons. I mean, all the lot about the Iranians not developing nuclear weapons and the stupid deal that Obama and company did, absolutely ridiculous. Of course, the Israelis have them. I mean, but the Iranians have them. They're building them all. They haven't stopped. It's total rubbish. Look, the Mossad wouldn't worry about bumping anyone off if there was nothing happening. But that's beside the point. We're talking about Rothschild. He started that network, intelligence network, and that was part of the deal that he would set that up, and he did, and it's been very effective. Just as a sidelight, my good mate Jack fought for the British in the Middle East, and then when the fight for Israel had been developed, he joined the Haganah. So he was fighting against the Brits, effectively. He's no one more British than good old Jack, but he did have the dual operation there. He went over and fought again in the Middle East, this time against the British to help set up the State of Israel. And the Brits didn't want Israel for one particular reason. They weren't anti-Semitic. That's ridiculous. They wanted it because they had such terrific contacts in the Middle East and setups in Saudi, Lebanon, everywhere, Syria from World War One. They did not want a rogue state implanted into the middle of the Middle East that they had no control of. And that's why they were very much against the development of Israel.
No, I mean, I wonder, because the US, who were the first to recognize the State of Israel, and today, of course, there's something like $30 billion a year shoveled towards Israel from the US. Now, when all this US-Israeli cooperation started, around about the time of the Six-Day War, I think, and, well, I mean, it was probably going on before that, but it became massive. Obviously, the Americans came over in the October War in the 70s with loads and loads of military equipment to back up the Israelis. I mean, this is still that during the Cold War. Surely the Russians at that point are saying, well, you know, we want nothing to do with these Israelis. They're our enemy.
Well, they were. They were easing out of it because Stalin was long dead and his henchmen were long out of it. So they had no reason to support to support Israel. But don't forget, Rothschild was still there. Victor Nathaniel Mayer would have been saying, well, we believe the state should be upheld. And he would have been doing that quietly on the side. It wasn't a major event for him after Israel, but he definitely had some influence. But yeah, of course, and the Americans have, because of the very powerful Jewish community, have kept that state running. It's interesting at the moment, though, whether they've pulled off a coup or not with all those other states supporting Israel and becoming friends, quote-unquote. Very interesting time, actually. All the other peace accords have fallen apart, and we don't know what will happen under Biden if he is actually elected, because he is in the pocket of so many people, particularly the Chinese.
Yeah, particularly the Chinese. Anyway, Kevin, I mean, it's a bit of a tour de force through the decades there, almost a century, really. First of all, have you got any comments on what you've just heard? What do you make of that? And also where we're heading now with Biden?
Okay, let's start back to front. Biden has appointed as his chief of intelligence Elaine Haines. She has form on black ops, spying on the Senate, waterboarding. She was in the CIA. So I don't think we're going to see any change under Biden. It'll be more of the same pre-Trump. Whatever Obama was up to, it'll be more of the same. And that includes Israel. I don't think he's going to step away. Because if you have rogue states in the Middle East, you have Israel as an expendable buffer zone. Now, I don't know if you saw, there's been an article this week in The Guardian today, and the Israelis are expanding their nuclear weapons plant. Now, the problem with this is nuclear weapons are strategic weapons. They're not kind of artillery shells you drop on a place. Three nuclear bombs and Israel is gone. It's in a terribly vulnerable position. So increasing its weapon production is a typical Netanyahu ploy. But if anything goes wrong, three bombs and you're out. But I think looking at the appointments Biden has made, we're in for Obama 2. That's what we're going to get.
Yeah, I mean, it's Avril Haines you're talking about, Biden's new director of national intelligence. So she is, from CIA. It just seems like, you know, you've got the very worst of the crooked secret services, black ops people being recruited and basically rewarded with positions of enormous power under Biden, which is worrying in itself. But what about, talking about nuclear stuff, I mean, Roland is saying, effectively, he doesn't believe, and I'm not sure I do, that the Iranians don't have nuclear weapons. I mean, it's one of those things that we're told again and again by the mainstream press that they don't. But, I mean, in a way, they would be silly not to. And I can remember back in the 90s watching a BBC documentary it was done, I'm not quite sure who the presenter, the journalist was, where they showed, I think it was either in Ukraine or Belarus, a nuclear weapons store of some kind, where the weapons were going in and out, and they were very interested. Journalists having a look and saying, "Well, gosh!" And of course, the actual guards on this place hadn't been paid for many months and months anyway. And so obviously, the black market is operating in that sort of situation, where someone might come along and give them a whole load of dollars or whatever cash for a nuclear weapon of some sort. And they were watching these trucks going in; they were filming them going in to the base. And then they were filming them coming out and showing that they were right down on their axles on the way out, which does suggest that maybe, a few bags of uranium might have been in those trucks as they were heading out. And I always remember that they said that they traced those trucks and they followed them back to Iran. So, I mean, if Roger Cook, in his Cook report, can get hold of an offer of an SS-20 on the black market, surely, Kevin, that the Iranians or anybody else who's threatened with nuclear weapons so directly as they were by Israel at the time, is that going to be able to get their hands on some of these ex-Russian nukes on the black market?
I actually wrote stories in the late 1980s because I picked it up. Some folks from the Royal Navy were sent to Russia in the early 90s when the Soviet Union collapsed to check what nuclear weapons were floating about, and certainly some were missing. And you know, as I say, I spoke to, these were Royal Navy people I knew personally. And certainly, yes, there were nuclear weapons. And then there was a story, which, again, I knew somebody who knew the guy, Khashoggi, the Saudi arms dealer. The Saudis had, he was in disgrace. The Saudis took him out of disgrace and put him in a private jet. And he had a budget of $200 million flying into Tajikistan, which is where some of the Soviet stockpile was. Yeah, I think there are bombs around the place that nobody's talking about. Nobody's telling us.
Well, yeah, glad to hear you say that, because, I mean, to me, it's obvious. As a public interest, public-spirited journalist, we need to be saying this stuff because, you know, we could even have some sort of false flag attack by using one of these nuclear weapons. And it would automatically be blamed on somebody. So it's a bit like the chemical weapons attacks in Syria. You know, as soon as you see something like this happen, folks, switch your television recorder on or whatever and think that probably the opposite of what you're being told or who has done it has probably done it. Because this is the way that the public is led into these bigger conflicts. Anyway, OK, so I'm going to let you go in a minute, Kevin. Are you OK to stay for a little bit longer?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so let's have a look now at the film, which has been deleted this week. We will be going back to talk a bit about COVID in a minute, but I thought it was well worth a look, this. And it was. I haven't actually watched the whole thing yet. I haven't had a chance. I only downloaded it yesterday, but it's disappeared today off of BitChute. A fascinating film. And what I will do on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, I will put up a full copy of the audio of the documentary. I think it's about an hour and 20 minutes or an hour and a half even. It's been produced by French writer Laurent Guyenot, G-U-Y-E-N-O-T, and is Laurent, L-A-U-R-N-E-T, E-N-T, sorry. And it's the actual title of it is Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers, and it's subtitled JFK and 9/11, 50 years of the deep state. So let's have a listen to a clip from this immediately banned off BitChute documentary now.
We will talk later about John Kennedy's tense relationship with the state of Israel. As for his brother, he had not been in his brother's government a particularly pro-Israel attorney general. He had infuriated Zionist leaders by supporting an investigation led by Senator William Fulbright of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations aimed at registering the American Zionist Council as a foreign agent, subject to the obligations defined by the Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938, which would have considerably hindered its efficiency. After the assassination of John Kennedy, the American Zionist Council escaped this procedure, and its lobbying division, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, became the most powerful lobby in the United States and an indispensable instrument for the corruption and intimidation of American elected officials and for the control of American foreign policy. It was Nicholas Katzenbach, whom Johnson put at the head of the Department of Justice to replace Robert Kennedy, who buried the case against the American Zionist Council. Katzenbach is also known as having strongly recommended to the new president, Lyndon Johnson, a commission of inquiry to establish as soon as possible that Oswald was the only assassin of Kennedy. In conclusion, it is only by an outrageous hypocrisy that the Jewish Daily Forward could write on June 6, 2008, quote, "In remembering Bobby Kennedy, let us remember not just what he lived for, but also what he died for, namely the precious nature of the American-Israeli relationship," end of quote. Robert Kennedy's death had not been a bad thing for the American-Israeli relationship. As a U.S. president, would Robert have saved Israel from disaster in 1973, like Nixon and Kissinger, by providing her with unlimited military support against Egypt? It is unlikely. Rather, Robert Kennedy was a great loss for the Arab world, as had his brother John before him. Of course, the fact that the Zionist media lied when granting Robert Kennedy some kind of posthumous certificate of goodwill towards Israel, and thereby provided Israel with a kind of fake alibi, is not a sufficient reason for accusing Israel of having murdered Robert. Even the fact that the masterminds of the plot chose as their programmed instrument an anti-Zionist Palestinian, and thereby stirred a strong anti-Palestinian feeling among Americans at the same time as getting rid of Robert, does not prove that Israel was involved. What is lacking for a serious presumption is a plausible motive, and the motive of Robert's assassination, as we said before, must be found not in what Robert was declaring publicly during his campaign, but rather in what he confided only to his close friends, his intention to reopen the investigation on his brother's death. What would an unbiased investigation conducted under the supervision of Robert in the White House have revealed? This is what we must now determine.
So that's Laurent.
Fascinating. That is.
Guillenot's there. Yeah, I mean, he goes also in the documentary, the sections I've watched, into the connections with the Israeli mafia to Jack Ruby as well, who's the guy that shot dead Lee Harvey Oswald, who's the main suspect at the time. Of course, he was now known to be a patsy, although this is something that doesn't seem to have got through to BBC documentary maker Adam Curtis. I was absolutely appalled to see during the week in his new series, the first one, where he's saying, oh, anybody that thinks that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill President Kennedy is a nutcase. Now, this is not professional journalism at all. You know, he's not even looking at the possibility and the absolute fact of the connections through people like David Attlee Phillips and the Chicago Mafia that the CIA was most definitely involved in killing him, and that this was just a convenient assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald, who was supposed to be the guy that did it, you know, set up for it. But anyway, what do you make of that, Kevin? The various political shifts that took place within the American government, within the deep state, effectively, after the deaths of the two Kennedy brothers?
Well, this Sirhan, the guy who shot Robert Kennedy, is a mystery. His motives have never been properly established. I think it's perfectly legitimate what this chap is raising. And the second thing, the only technical comment I can make is I'm ex-army and I trained, let's say, up to sniper level. I never made it, but I know what's involved. And it's extremely unlikely that a sniper where Harvey Oswald was in the warehouse would have been able to hit a moving target from that distance and get the target in the head. To me, that's suspicious. And then Sirhan, where did he come from? I think it's a legitimate subject, and I think I have heard before that Robert Kennedy, if he became president or attorney general, had every intention of reopening the investigation. I have heard that in reliable form.
Week after week, we are reopening the investigation. I'm sorry, whoever killed Robert Kennedy, but that is, you're not going to make this go away by just killing people off, because there's something called journalism goes on in humanity, and we will track you down. So that was the actual title of that is Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers. Fascinating documentary by Laurent Guillenot, and I will put up.
Watch it.
I will. Well, you can't, I'm afraid. I've got a copy of it. Maybe I could send space it to you. What I may do is send space it to Kevin and then put a link up on our show page so people can download it. It's called JFK and 9/11, 50 Years of the Deep State. Fascinating documentary. Of course, it's been taken down because of accusations of anti-Semitism. That's why. And this is apparently a crime. If you're saying anything that's critical of the state of Israel, generally speaking, that's what's going on here, then you're considered by some people who are rather unhinged to be anti-Semitic, and you're doing it because they're Jewish, not because they're criminals or because they're assassins or because they're murderers in that case. So let's also Final piece with you, Kevin. I think I might just cut things reasonably short and maybe do some of these bits and pieces next week with Martin. Is we've got Bilderberg. There's a woman called Natalie Minnis who was on this program a couple of weeks ago, and she is very concerned about a guy called Klaus Schwab. Now, have you heard of him?
No.
He's the boss of the World Economic Forum and the front man for the Great Reset, along with Prince Charles. So Natalie has got very, I found it fascinating that she has dug out all sorts of stuff to do with Klaus Schwab's internet trace being disappeared. So things like Wikipedia entries disappearing, or lines and interesting information about Klaus Schwab disappearing from Wikipedia and from places like the Bilderberg website. So let's have a listen now to Natalie Minnis from Scotland, and I'll put a link up to her podcast, which is called Imagining Freedom, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks, Natalie, for sending this in. It's a much longer podcast here, but we're going to hear a little clip from it now, about 5 minutes, where she talks about the Bilderbergs and how Klaus Schwab has been so very much involved with them. These are the people I've been investigating, of course, over the years. And I was particularly annoyed to discover that for the first 20 years after they were founded in 1954 in Oosterbeek in Holland, just on the same site as the Battle of Arnhem, the Witch's Cauldron was a massacre of the British 1st Airborne Troops. Funnily enough, the guy who was supposed to be in charge of that operation, General Boy Browning, who later went on to manage the financial affairs of the Duke of Edinburgh, he didn't even land in the main area there with the paratroopers. He went a little bit back from the front line. And funnily enough, all those British paratroopers, many of them were massacred and surrounded by the Nazis at the time. So I would have thought a good general should be landing at least somewhere close to the spearhead of his attack rather than somewhere it's nice and safe behind the lines. But anyway, it was in the outskirts of Arnhem, in the little town of Oosterbeek, where the Bilderberg conferences first started, chaired by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands for the first 20 years. Who was an ex-SS officer who had managed to get into the Dutch royal family and then skip and jump into British intelligence. And so he, it's now absolutely clear, sent this agent in to talk to the Abwehr before the Battle of Arnhem, this is in the film A Bridge Too Far, took place. So this is the origins of the Bilderberg, is in the blood of World War II, in the Witch's Cauldron of Oosterbeek, which was where the German tanks were massacring the British paratroopers who then had to retreat. And I think it's a sort of a nod and a wink, really, a quiet in joke, that's why the Bilderbergs 10 years later started this series of conferences in that specific place. And that's taken me a few years to track that down with various people's help, including that of Dave Barmby from Whitney in Oxfordshire, who helped out a lot in that investigation. And so anyway, let's have a listen now to, we're trying to connect this to Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum, and today, who's about to bring in this thing in June this year called the Great Reset, which is going to apparently reset the world economy on the lines of something which is going to be green and environmentally friendly, although I'm not sure if he's going to do anything about the 1,000 times more energy that 5G uses than the fiber broadband. So we want fiber, please. But no, Klaus and his chums want to bring in something which is going to use loads more energy, and they're trying to pretend they're greens. Anyway, let's have a listen to the Bilderberg slavery clip from Natalie Minnis and her podcast this week now.
We currently have a situation where unelected people are taking it upon themselves to direct the course of our lives. And this is happening throughout the world. I find this very scary. And it's people who have been acting in the background, more or less. So last year, we suddenly had the situation where this man, Klaus Schwab, who had been a prominent leader before, but in the background, you know, on the business pages of the newspapers, and we suddenly had this man taking the centre stage and actually saying with a big smile on his face what we would be doing in the next few years, directing us from his organisation, the World Economic Forum. Where did this organisation come from? When all this started to happen, when Klaus Schwab suddenly was centre stage, I, like probably millions of other people, thought, who is this man? So I looked to Wikipedia, like probably millions of people did. And I find it a very disjointed description, because it just said that this man had been born in Germany, he was the son of an industrialist, and he'd gone to university and got a degree, and then he'd got another degree. He seems to have done pretty well. I think he became an engineer, wrote a few books, and at the age of 33, he created this organisation called the European Management Forum, which then became the World Economic Forum, which happens to be one of the organisations that's almost leading the world. How did that happen? How did he become... How did he get that success, that massive success, to become a world leader without ever having been elected, for his organisation to have suddenly become so massively influential in the world? I knew when I read that. I kept reading it over and over again because I knew that there was something missing here. And I searched, I did an online search. I mean, all the libraries were closed, so I didn't have any alternative. And I had to search back quite a bit before I found an article which mentioned the Bilderberg Group and said that Klaus Schwab had actually been on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. And although it was quite a well-sourced article, it didn't source that particular piece of information, so I had to do more research. And I found this page from bilderbergmeetings.org, which had been archived. So it had been retrieved from archive.org, which means that it had been deleted. And it was a list of all the members of the Bilderberg Steering Group, which had been public but had since been deleted. And that's raised a big question in my mind. I thought, why are they deleting these pages? I got the impression that Mr. Schwab's biography, his online profile, had been tidied up quite a bit. So he was on the steering group of the Bilderberg several times. On the Wikipedia page, it also shows a list of these accolades that he's been given. So there's clearly been a lot going on behind the scenes. The Bilderberg Group is often dismissed as a kind of big conspiracy theory that it's... I first heard of it in the early 2000s, and I heard through people like Alex Jones. I've never followed Alex Jones, but I think he was on a TV programme with John Ronson at one point, and I can't remember whether it was on that programme or somewhere else. But that's around the time that I heard about it, and there were claims being made that it was very powerful, and that the people that went to the Bilderberg Group had a lot of influence over our so-called democratic leaders. And this was all seen as a big conspiracy theory, that we were just making too much of it, and this was just a conference where people discussed world affairs and why should we worry about it, etc. Well, now we're seeing why we need to worry about it. Now we're seeing in plain sight how this organisation has been managing things from the shadows, really, and is now coming out and laying down the law for people all over the world. Over the years, I've felt that we're moving to a situation where we've got a small, homogeneous elite directing the masses, and the masses are all equal, and we're equal in the way, in a kind of equal slavery. That's what we seem to be moving towards. And I've seen this happening for so long that before I started this podcast, I was thinking about it before the COVID thing even started, and I was going to call it Welcome to the Plantation, because having ancestors, quite close ancestors, who were slaves. My great-grandfather was the son of two freed slaves in the Caribbean. I started to recognise things that seemed to be reminiscent of slavery.
So that's Natalie Minnis there. Kevin, what do you make of that?
That was very interesting. But I knew about Bilderberg back in the 80s. They go back a way. And she's talking about these people influencing the democratically elected leaders. Lots of the so-called democratically elected leaders used to attend Bilderberg as fully fledged members of the Bilderberg Group. People like, you know, the Irish Prime Minister, the British Prime Minister, lots of them used to attend. So whatever was going on was intended to influence them directly.
Well, one of the things I've noticed with them, obviously following them since 1996, I remember the penny dropped in my mind just outside the Royal Festival Hall on the South Bank. God, I'm going to have to put up a web page about this. And, of course, it's now there. It's www.bilderberg.org. And you can find out a lot about the background on there about these people. And I realised that there was a whole area that was basically that the journalists either couldn't or wouldn't write about. And then I slowly understood that this is actually not really the journalists that don't know or want to write about it. This is the people that own the printing presses, the people that own the, and control the transmitters. Those Murdoch, are the people who...
Murdoch was an attender at the early Bilderberg.
Well, that's right. And I wonder whether he's still on board. You never know. But one of the things that they did was they always invited people who were up and coming in politics. So, for example, Robin Cook for the Labour Party, he went along to he was on the invite list for a Bilderberg meeting. And then if you look at the details, you'll find that when he actually came to the final list for and these lists, generally you can only get hold of them afterwards. But this is one of those that's been leaked long after, probably a decade after, in the 1990s, where Robin Cook was obviously invited and either turned them down or he made some constrictions on his attendance that they wouldn't fulfill. Anyway, they fell out with him. And he never went along to the meeting. But this is one of the things they're always trying to do, is to recruit people who it looks like will be the next powerful politicians. And I think that they're now in the position, a very strong position now, where you don't get anybody really involved in politics, hardly anybody at all, who hasn't been through their system and hasn't been approved by them, Kevin.
Yeah, no, that's what you do. You pick people showing signs of leadership qualities, LQs, and you offer them, you know, scholarships to Harvard or to, where did that mayor of yours go to? Yale. And Navalny. And but they do scan, they look around to see who's up and coming, and they're not bothered about which party. They prefer Tories, obviously, but Labour... I tell you one person I think from memory, but I hope I'm not... saying it's wrong, but I think Kate Hoey was one of the people picked a long way back as a future leader by these kind of groups.
Well, quite possibly, yeah. Anyway, so that was Natalie Minnis, and her podcast is called Imagining Freedom. And I'll put a link up to that, the full version on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Nice one, Natalie. Good to see a bit of proper investigative journalism going on. Even if it's just, you know, us and are you up in Scotland, nothing really on the TV about any of this. And that, well, I'll just explain why. It's because the people that own the televisions and own the transmitters don't want to talk about this. That they basically keep the lid on it all because it suits them. It would be nice, wouldn't it, to think that some of these new TV channels coming along, some of this sort of thing can be discussed, since it's actually the kind of cutting edge, really, of investigative journalism. So I guess we should. How are you getting on, Kevin? I think we should be winding up soon, don't you think?
Yeah, I think I need to eat something.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, okay.
The old diabetes.
Okay. Well, let's just finish with something short, and we'll do some of the other stuff next week. But this is a clip from Dennis Wheatley.
I used to love Dennis Wheatley. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was very popular, wasn't he, in the 1960s and 70s.
Hugely popular, immensely popular. Black Magic and all that stuff. Very innocent.
He did do that, but he also did some terrific, whole load of terrific historical novels, some about the Second World War, some about the Napoleonic era, all sorts, really. I'm absolutely disgusted. You know what I found out the other day? I went into Waterstones before Christmas over in Gloucester, which is quite a big shop, and I said, oh, have you got anything by Walter Scott? And the person behind the desk said, oh, well, who's he? I said, well, he's the inventor of the novel. Well, I mean, yeah. You know, this is where we are now, is that the people who actually established things like the very first, I mean, he was writing, I think he was about 1815 or something, 20, I'm not sure, Kevin. But the idea that, you know, there's nothing in a bookshop by Sir Walter Scott. This is the bloke that invented this you know, the writer.
Novel, the modern novel, yeah.
Nothing at all. So the same exactly is true for Dennis Wheatley. Nothing at all, and generally in many of these shops by him, even though he's an absolutely brilliant, fantastic writer. And I remember one of my colleagues at the Journalist Union would say, oh, look, you've got a real book. He noticed in my bag I had a Wheatley novel I was reading. Oh, you got a real book there. Not this like this rubbish they have nowadays. Anyway, so here's Dennis Wheatley, and we'll just finish with this clip, and I'll just get your comments on it, Kevin, and then we'll close. Where he's describing back in the 1970s in a BBC interview why he believes the forces of darkness are threatening to come out on top.
You say that today the powers of darkness in its eternal war, the power of darkness in its eternal war with the power of light, is threatening to come out on top. If this continues on an ever-increasing scale, the inevitable result will be a return to the brutal lawlessness, poverty, and insecurity of the Dark Ages. Do you really believe that about the modern
day? I do believe that. The violence and that sort of thing that's going on today is unbelievable, and the government are not controlling it. And that doesn't go only for this country. It's all over Europe and the United States worse than ever. And they've just got to take a line.
Well, give me an example of how the power of darkness, as you call it, is operating in this town, in this country today.
Well, there are said to be over 300 covens in this country. Covens, that is 13 people making up a coven of witches. And they're increasing every day, I suppose, because the two world wars have made great insecurity with young people, and they're looking for something, you must have something to cling on to, and they are tempted by these evil people, not necessarily people who have real power, but evil people to come to these parties. We'll promise you want to marry the boss, all right, you come along on Tuesday, have a little fun and that sort of thing, and so on. And that is where an immense amount of dope pushing, that sort of thing, goes on, because witches and their servants have always used drugs.
Do you know, have you met modern witches?
When I first wrote my first book on black magic, before I wrote it, I took trouble to get an introduction to Aleister Crowley, to Rollo Ahmed, to Harry Price, Montague Summers, all of whom were top boys in that line. And I used to have them to lunch and dinner and talk to them. I had many conversations, but I've never dabbled in it myself because I am absolutely certain no good can come of it. And you'll probably get so interested in this thing that you'll neglect your wife, you'll neglect your job, and there it is, if you're weak-minded, you can end up in a loony bin.
I wonder if you don't perhaps sometimes feel a sense of responsibility yourself for the state of affairs, because there is no doubt your books sell in absolutely fabulous numbers. Are you catering for the very thing that you are against?
I can't believe that, because in every book I write, I always give a warning that this thing is evil and no good can ever come to anybody who dabbles in it.
You haven't quite answered my question. Aren't you feeding the curiosity that is creating this evil?
No, I don't. I feel that by warning people, so many people are drawn into this thing, and I feel that I at least am in warning them. It's not a good thing to do.
Do you think they might ever strike at you?
No, I have complete confidence in my own protection, because they can only strike at people who are afraid and who believe that they can be harmed. And I don't. I don't say that I'm a particularly good person, but I believe that I'm on the right side. And I believe the powers of light will protect me from anything that anybody could ever attempt about me.
But you're fearful the powers of darkness may take us over.
I think that civilization is disintegrating. Unless somebody takes a pull, things are getting worse and worse every year.
Well, that's the voice of Dennis Wheatley there, speaking in the 1970s, I'm guessing, to...
That was fabulous. I don't think I'd ever heard his voice. He was quite posh, and he was hugely rich. The other thing is, he could have been Ian Fleming. He could have written the Bond novels. He and Fleming worked together in Navy intelligence in the war.
That's right, they did. And I actually think that Fleming did write his novels, but that Wheatley encouraged him to write, because after the war, Fleming hit the bottle, after having been involved in so much skullduggery, and Wheatley gently nudged him and said, look, you can write about it. Fleming then said, well, I can't. It's all the Official Secrets Act. He said, well, do what I do. Write a novel. They can't get you for that. And off went Fleming.
Brilliant. He mentioned Aleister Crowley.
Yeah. Yeah, he's top boys in that line, he said. All the top boys in that line.
Yeah, well, Crowley certainly was. But generally, it is thought that Crowley really did get into the serious stuff, you know, raising the dead and all this sort of stuff. He was quite serious about what he was trying to do. Nobody ever found out if he did it.
Well, going through various rituals and ending up with people dead at the end of the ritual. But anyway, so one of the things that's sort of missing today, Kevin, is this whole idea of moral fibre. You know, we don't seem to have so much of that around, and something that Wheatley and people like that believed in.
No, everything is money. It's money is, there's nothing, you need money to, you know, to be able to live in the world. But when money becomes an obsession and drives out everything else, and I think Murdoch is a classic example. Murdoch has no morality, only money. And indirectly, that's what Dennis Wheatley was trying to say. You know, if there's nothing independent, say, of money, then the forces of darkness arrive.
Well, it's almost like a religion. It seems to be becoming money. You're not allowed to get even, you know, you can get not even allowed to have a carrier bag for free at the supermarket anymore.
No. But that's possibly a good thing. I mean,
well,
the
maybe,
oceans
but,
are
you know, you know, things that, the free toilets are closed. All the toilets here in Bristol pretty much have been shut now.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, so we're paying all our taxes to a government and to a local authority that don't seem to think that they've got to provide any services. In fact, here where I am in St. Paul's, we've got just got fly tipping all over the streets. And you do wonder if we're getting anything whatsoever at all for our council tax.
Well, this is the kind of people like Murdoch who have the money are driving out any sense of public duty or kind of independent, what you call moral fibre. They don't believe in it.
Okay, so what do we do about it, Kevin?
We keep right on trucking and exposing. We will get there. We'll get there. Well, I drove five of the biggies into either a draw or giving me money. Yeah. I'm not giving up, are you?
Certainly not, no. Well, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest. Good. That's former Sunday Times Rich List journalist and author of Who Owns Britain and many other books. When's Who Owns Ireland coming out? Any idea, Kevin?
The publisher seems to have vanished. I am in search of a missing publisher.
Okay, so he's been thrown down the oubliette, maybe?
I don't know whether they've closed down or what they've done, but the book was finished. They got the complete manuscript.
So that's Kevin Carhill, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s, and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, even though shadow banned. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. This show is repeated at 11 on Fridays, 11 p.m. that is, and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday lunch in two places, from noon at richieallen.co.uk sometimes, and regularly at Camberley's RadioQUK.com. Do please make recordings of the stream, unless our MP3 platform is down, which it is sometimes at weekends. Do feel free to download and rebroadcast this show anywhere you like, and we'll list you here. Let us know. And do credit this show at thisweek.org.uk. And you can request this show's reinstatement on FM. Links to email the head BCFM honchos are on the contact tab and our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Illuminati, a secret society do exist. Illuminati, Illuminati, a secret society do exist. Illuminati,
secret society do exist. Illuminati. T.